You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Christine Ahn. Christine is the founder and the international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, and we'll talk about that. This is a group of women mobilizing for peace in Korea. Christine Ahn is a writer and an organizer working for peace and justice and demilitarization of our world. Christine Ahn, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
How are you liking the Olympics so far?
Oh, it's so moving.
The opening ceremony.
I think it just deeply touched not just the Korean people, but I think the people of the world.
Were you surprised by the extent of the measures that they went to unify the two Koreas?
I mean, I had actually tweeted days before that there were so many pundits that were kind of, you know, the way I put it, throwing shade on, you know, the two Koreas and, you know, this whole rhetoric around Pyongyang's charm offensive and, you know, to really just try to denigrate this incredibly magnanimous and bold act by the two Koreas. And so I said, you know, don't underestimate the power of seeing two Koreas march together under a one Korea flag. And I think that's exactly what happened. I think just especially those that understand the tragic modern history of Korea and to know how Korea was divided, to know the enormous destruction and death of the caused by the Korean War, and to know that, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Korean families still remain separated because of the most militarized border in the world. To see that kind of putting aside of enmity and hostility, to recognize that they need to come together to avert a disastrous nuclear war that is being threatened, not, you know, by the United States. I think that was it was extraordinary, and I mean, you know, all aspects of it, from the beautiful display to the ending of the ceremony with, you know, the song Imagine, with, you know, the shapes of a dove. I mean, you know, I just think the South Korea and Moon Jae-in, they invested so much to really reflect, I think, the deep power and sentiment of the Korean people for unity.
I doubt that an Olympics in the United States would permit such references to peace and doves and Imagine by John Lennon. It was beyond what I had hoped for. And yet you saw this beautiful opening ceremony and everyone standing and cheering for the two teams coming in as one with one Korean flag. But there were two people sitting, not standing, not cheering, just sitting on their butts and glaring around, to the embarrassment, I would hope, of everyone in the United States, although I don't think the NBC commentators mentioned Mike Pence and his wife.
Right, and I think also Shinzo Abe did not applaud.
Notice him. I don't. Maybe the camera didn't include him that I saw, but.
Yeah, and so I think that that is really interesting, disturbing, and a true affront to Korean people. You know, as I noted, the modern history of Korea really starts with the collusion between the U.S. and Japan that led to the colonial occupation of Korea. So in 1905, the war secretary, William Taft, signs with the count, Katsuda, the Taft-Katsuda secret agreement, where basically both governments agreed to look the other way as the U.S. colonized both Hawaii and Japan, I mean, Hawaii and the Philippines, while Japan invaded Korea. And so just seeing that the two leaders, Abe and Mike Pence, not stand literally for Korean unity, and knowing this kind of deep and dark history, is truly an affront to Korean people. And, you know, I noted, like, how ironic is it that the two leaders of the governments that have the largest and heaviest military footprint on Korean soil be the ones to be sowing bitterness and discord at this incredibly hopeful and moving ceremony.
Yeah.
I think it's quite telling and so important, especially for the U.S. population to know this, because we are in this kind of historic moment. And I think what happens in the coming weeks and months will very much determine whether there will be war or peace on the Korean Peninsula.
The NBC talking head, I don't know the guy's name, kept referring to the threat from across the border and the service of the U.S. troops in South Korea, and even referred to Japan as a great model and inspiration for every single person in Korea. And NBC later had to apologize for that. What do you think U.S. viewers who watch this on television, do you think they understood what the rest of the world was seeing?
I don't know, because I think that there is a grave distortion that the Korean War is just a war between North and South Korea.
Yeah.
And that it has nothing to do with the U.S., which is incredible to me that we are, you know, in this situation where the U.S., destroyed 80% of North Korean cities through its air bombing campaign. And the U.S. is the one that divided the Korean Peninsula. And, you know, it's the U.S. that still has 30,000 troops in South Korea and regularly conducts these joint war drills that is provoking North Korea, that includes such things as decapitation strikes. It is actually threatening North Korea, which is why North Korea has said that they have pursued a nuclear deterrent. And so, you know, it's complicated, because on the one hand, it's like, I think, you know, American people were so moved by this Korean unity, but have no idea what their own government is doing to create discord on the Korean Peninsula.
But I can imagine viewers in the headquarters of Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman throwing stuff at the television. I mean, they don't want, they have to have the appearance of Korean disunity for the war to be between South and North Korea. And I think it's, you know, the U.S. understanding is even worse than that, because the U.S. public is now convinced that North Korea is a threat to the United States, not just, you know, one partner in a civil war far away, but that the big danger to the United States, the reason for more U.S. military spending, is the threat from North Korea.
Absolutely. I mean, I was just speaking in Albany last night, and I rolled out a bunch of statistics and a bunch of quotes, like the former admiral of the U.S. Pacific Command, you know, which is the command that is in charge of overseeing, you know, the U.S. armed and, you know, naval air forces in the Asia Pacific region based in Hawaii. And, you know, he has said that North Korea is not a threat. And, you know, they are a threat because we make them a threat, but they are not a threat. And we have given the North Koreans far too much credit. And even when I went to an event in Hawaii, that's where I'm based, you know, somebody cited the U.S. Pacific Command saying there's a 0.01% chance that North Korea would launch a missile at the United States, because it would be suicide for them. And so even though I trot out these facts and these statistics, you know, a woman still stood up and she said, I hear you, but the images that I get about Kim Jong-un and the threat to American security by the North Korean government still terrifies me. And I said, well, I understand that because there is no communication between the U.S. and North Korea. And given what we saw with what happened in Hawaii with this false alarm about a so-called North Korean missile coming towards Hawaii, yeah. that there is so much room for human error that could lead to a devastating nuclear war. So I understand that, but somehow we have to drill down into the minds of the American people that the threat is really the recklessness of the Trump administration. It is the unpredictability of this administration, and that they could use, or, you know, just as the history of whether it's the Bay of Pigs or, you know, various, you know, actions that they have done to provoke other countries, you know, secretly or not secretly, you know, that's what worries me, I guess, is, you know, as the Mueller investigation encircles the Trump administration, that they could use a some kind of military skirmish to distract the American people and, you know, kind of project this we're strong and we're strong in national defense and, you know, just like carry out this narrative that has worked in the past to both, you know, just distract and confuse the American people. So that's my fear, to be honest with you. It's not at all that North Korea would do that. I don't think that they would do that. I agree with the military, the U.S. military, that that would just be an impossible scenario. But I do worry about what our military or what the Trump administration is capable of doing. Yeah. Some kind of malfeasance. Yeah.
Beyond North Korea sending a missile into the United States, which I don't know if it's even capable of, and as you say, it would be suicidal. It would only do it in retaliation against the United States. What about the people who email me all the time and say that I need to support war or start learning the North Korean language? I'm not sure there even is such a language, but correct me if I'm wrong. But people, actual human beings in the United States walking and breathing, believe that that North Korea is going to come here and occupy the United States and take it over. What's the percentage chance on that one?
I mean, 0% chance. I mean, North Korea has been, look, it's an authoritarian regime, and I'm not trying to justify the kind of brutal humanitarian or human rights abuses that the government imposes on its people. But there is a historical explanation for why that country is as paranoid as it is. And it has a lot to do with the fact that there has never been a formal end to the state of war on the Korean Peninsula. It has everything to do with the kind of brutal, devastating air bombing campaign that they endured during the Korean War, where 1 in 3 North Koreans were killed, where, you know, foreign journalists that went to North Korea to say that it felt like it was like walking on the moon. The only thing standing were chimneys. Otherwise, it was, you know, piles of ashes throughout. I mean, when I traveled to North Korea and I go to Pyongyang, which is a modern industrial city, and, you know, our minders are saying, oh, and there's that so-and-so building. And, you know, it's a restaurant. And it's a beautiful Korean restaurant and it's a traditional Korean building. But I wondered, why do they keep pointing that out? And that's because that was the only building that was remaining from the Korean War. And so if we could understand that experience of the North Korean people and how farmers had to build shelters, how they had to farm at nighttime so that they wouldn't be subjected to just like indiscriminate bombing, that kind of bomb shelter mentality is the kind of mentality that has shaped modern North Korean society. And I often point to a story that Stephen Kinzer, the New York Times, the former New York Times war reporter, wrote about the Dulles brothers. And he points to a situation where it was, I think, in 1954, and the CIA had just overthrown the democratically elected president from Guatemala, Arbenz. And I believe it was Che Guevara was there as a doctor to kind of witness the overthrow. And so Fidel Castro and Che Guevara met in Mexico for the first time, and they discussed what had happened, how the U.S. and the CIA had, you know, done this coup and the overthrow of a democratically elected president in Guatemala. And they made a pact at that point that in their commitment to liberate Cuba from U.S. occupation, that that they would not create an open society, a democratic society that would be vulnerable to a U.S. invasion. And so I have to say that it takes two to tango. And as much as we want to just lay the blame on the North Korean regime for its like brutal policies, we also have to see the kind of geopolitical context in which North Korea is surrounded by, you know, the world's most powerful military right across its border that is regularly practicing an invasion of that country. And so, if you know, it's just this counterintuitive thing. We allegedly care so much about the North Korean people's human rights, yet our government imposes the strongest economic blockade. I mean, UNICEF has just come out with a report saying that up to 60,000 North Korean children could starve as a result of the new rounds of sanctions. And so here we have a president in his State of the Union speech talk about the depraved North Korean regime. Well, we have to look. We have to put the mirror up and say, how much are our policies of military aggression and of economic blockade of that country impacting the day-to-day existence of the North Korean people?
It's interesting. I'm correct me if I'm wrong in recalling that Arbenz had supported North Korean charges against the U.S. Of using bioweapons, of using germ warfare, in addition to all of the indiscriminate bombing in that war.
Oh, I have no idea about that, David, but that is amazing.
Well, I could be, as I say, I could be wrong. That's what I recall. Christine, are there not some signs of hope in that there's been some support for an Olympic truce? There's been some pause in these flights, in these war rehearsals, or as they call them, war exercises. And now I understand that the president of South Korea may be headed to a meeting in North Korea. Is that correct? And is that worth something?
Oh, David, it's the bright light in this moment. And you know, the New York Times article yesterday had at the very end, of course, had an exchange where Prime Minister Shinzo Abe had asked Moon Jae-in to resume the military exercises at the end of the Olympics. And we know the U.S. has already declared that they would resume. And, you know, Moon Jae-in's response to Abe, I think, says a lot. And he said, don't meddle in Korean sovereignty or our internal affairs. And I think that is a sign of him potentially pivoting towards postponing the military exercises, at least until he goes to Pyongyang to have direct talks with the North Koreans. And I did, I reached out to a legal scholar at Columbia to ask him, well, what kind of power does Moon Jae-in have to unilaterally cancel these military exercises? And he wrote me back to say, actually, it might not be politically popular. Obviously, he would, you know, obviously it's significant to say to the U.S., we are not going to participate in these military exercises. But when you look at the mutual defense treaty between the U.S. and the ROK, South Korea in peacetime has operational control, and it is the military exercises on South Korean territory. So he does have the unilateral right legally to not to cancel the exercises. So
yeah.
I think that's very exciting. And I think right now is the moment for the American population to say this Olympic truce, where the U.S. did agree with South Korea to cancel and postpone the military exercises while the Olympics were taking place, is a very hopeful moment, and that we support extending the Olympic truce, that we don't want a war with North Korea, and that right now all sides seem to be backing down. North Korea has not tested a nuclear weapon or a missile, and right now is the moment for us to support this inter-Korean process and to de-escalate, that nobody wants war on the Korean Peninsula. We know that, contrary to Senator Lindsey Graham's accusations that a war would just be over there, you know, the Congressional Research Service says that within the first few days of a conflict, up to 300,000 people would be killed. That's including at least 100,000 Americans living in South Korea. It would result in massive retaliation against the U.S. bases in South Korea, in Japan, in Okinawa, in Guam. And we know that the Pentagon has said that, you know, to try to find the hidden and buried nuclear sites throughout North Korea would require a ground invasion that would include up to 600,000 troops. Like, who has those numbers of soldiers that would be willing to go and do that? And so I think that, you know, we can't be fooled to believe that the U.S. could just conduct some kind of bloody nose strike, a precision strike. That's a fantasy, but it is especially a fantasy in going to war against a country like North Korea.
Christine, on when Moon Jae-in first came in, it seemed like everyone was excited. Maybe this will be the guy who stands up to the United States. And then I guess he sort of was seen as caving in on THAAD missiles and U.S. weaponry in South Korea. Is there reason to think now that he's has the nerve to stand up to the U.S. military? And if so, what can people do to encourage him in that regard?
Well, I think that when he first came in, you know, it's not like he's a green politician. I mean, he was the chief of staff under Nobu Hyun, so he understands the kind of enormous political, economic, and military pressure that the U.S. wields, I mean, especially on South Korea. So I think he was just kind of getting his footing right, and obviously the North Korean provocations with the missile tests and stuff, obviously he has to deal with his domestic audience. And so, I think he was trying to get his footing. And then, you know, basically, I think once Donald Trump started to threaten North Korea that he would totally destroy North Korea at the UN, that, you know, we saw Moon Jae-in starting to come back and say, there will be no military action on the Korean Peninsula without the full consent and agreement of South Korea. And even when North Korea conducted its last long-range missile, he said he had a message both for Pyongyang but also for Washington, D.C., which is nothing will proceed, and the threat of military action must also stop. We see all this stuff about, oh, Pyongyang is driving a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea. Well, the real wedge is being driven by the Trump administration's recklessness. I mean, you can't threaten to wage a bloody nose strike and not have it have this massive repercussion on millions of South Koreans. I mean, that just makes absolutely no sense. I think, you know, Steve Bannon was absolutely right. You know, the North Koreans have us because, you know, there's just, I mean, this, it totally brings into the question then of why is the U.S. on the South Korean soil? Is it there to protect the South Korean people, or is it there to, like, just advance its own geopolitical interests? And so I think by threatening to do this military action against North Korea would lead to the devastation of South Korea. I think that it just led both Koreas to say, we have to talk. We have to de-escalate. We have to have Korea for Korea. And it's not just the U.S., but we also see China. We also see Russia. We also see very militaristic, provocative, actions coming from Japan. And so I think all those reasons probably compelled the two Koreas to just say, we need to talk. And the Olympics afforded just the brilliant cover for them to do so.
Very, very well said. Now that we have 2 minutes left, this incredible action that you all did crossing the DMZ, can you mention briefly what that was and what's come out of that since?
Well, we did it in 2015, and 30 women crossed. We held women's peace symposiums in both Pyongyang and also in Seoul, and we marched with 10,000 women in both North Korea and South Korea, but only the international women could cross the DMZ. But we called for an end to the Korean War with a peace treaty. We called for the reunification of families, and we called for women's leadership in the peace process, because we know when women's peace movements are involved in the peace process, not only does it lead to an actual peace agreement, but it actually leads to more durable ones. So that's what we've been pressing for. We've continued to do so. We did it in Vancouver just 2 weeks ago when the U.S. and Canada co-convened the meeting of foreign ministers that participated in the Korean War. And we'll continue to do so. And our hope is that we will be able to cross the DMZ, and that we will be able to have some kind of action this year of international women supporting North and South Korean women in this moment of inter-Korean reconciliation. So just stay tuned. We'll have more information, I'm sure, in the coming weeks.
And what can women, or men for that matter, do if they want to support, if they want to help promote your efforts?
Oh, well, it would be great. I think we're going to be putting out a call for women to join the delegation to South Korea first, because our hope is to meet first in South Korea and Seoul, have a gathering there, and then to try to cross the DMZ and have a gathering and symposium with women in North Korea. But the U.S. citizens face a travel ban that has been imposed by the Trump administration.
Right.
And so we're going to have to get, it's a much more complicated crossing this time because of that. But we need to challenge it, and this could be an opportunity to do so.
Very good. Christine Ahn is the founder of Women Cross DMZ, the international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ. Christine Ahn, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, David, for all your amazing work. It's really great to have you in our movement.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, what do you do with a press corps that pauses from raising alarms about North Korea's warmongering to raise alarms about North Korea's peacemongering? Signs of rapprochement between North and South Korea at the Pyongyang Olympics have led to media accounts warning Americans not to fall for peace offensive propaganda. But we are in favor of lowering tensions on the Korean Peninsula, right? Right. We'll talk about the prospects for war and for peace with North Korea with Christine Hong, associate professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and an executive board member of the Korea Policy Institute. Also on the show, a Senate committee investigation has just concluded that advocacy groups that got money from pharmaceutical companies, like the makers of OxyContin, then promoted opioids, like OxyContin, as safe, lobbied to change laws aimed at curbing their abuse, and sought to protect doctors charged with overprescribing them. Better late than never, but Counterspin listeners were on to this story at least 2 years ago when we spoke with investigative reporter Lee Fong. We'll revisit that relevant conversation. All of that's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Many were stirred by the sight of North and South Korean athletes parading together at the Winter Olympics opening ceremony in Pyeongchang. And that's a big problem, says Vice President Mike Pence, who declared, to some media applause, that he would seize every opportunity to stop North Korea from using the games as an opportunity for propaganda. There's something funny about decrying nationalist propaganda at the Olympics, but corporate media coverage of Korea is funny in a lot of ways. When the Washington Post writes gibberish about Pence's plan to, quote, fight propaganda with some no-nonsense spin of his own, close quote, that's of a piece with coverage in which North Korea and Kim Jong-un are cartoon demons, the definition of an official enemy. It all makes sense for those who require such an enemy, but what about those of us who don't sell weapons or appreciate threats of nuclear war? Joining us now to talk about all of this is Christine Hong, associate professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and an executive board member of the Korea Policy Institute. She joins us now by phone from Santa Cruz. Welcome to Counterspin, Christine Hong.
Thank you for having me, Janine.
Well, it's bizarre to hear Mike Pence say that North Korea has to end the day of provocation and menacing, that they can't be allowed to distract from their human rights record or weapons building. I do wonder how you react to statements like that. And then it's important to focus on what the U.S. does on the Korean Peninsula, isn't it? As much as what Pence or other officials might say.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned a number of things that I think are important to highlight in this particular moment, which is the fact that when Pence refused his South Korean host the courtesy of standing when the two Koreas marched under a unified banner, he was as much of a historical revisionist as that NBC reporter Josh Cooper Ramo, who was fired for making comments about the ways in which South Korea has taken its cues from Japan, which was a colonial occupier of Korea. And what I mean by this is that that particular flag, which showed the entire Korean Peninsula with absolutely no division, it represented the Korean Peninsula without U.S. interference. if we go back to the middle part of the 20th century, it was the United States under Truman. And it was Truman who, 3 days after the atomic bombing, U.S. atomic bombing of Nagasaki, who deputized two junior military officials who had absolutely no understanding of Korean history, who hadn't bothered to consult with any Korean, and who then divided Korea into two occupation zones at the 38th parallel, which precipitated an absolutely catastrophic and brutal war of national reunification that followed. And so it was the United States in the first instance that actually set the structural conditions for the Korean War, which has never ended. And so Pence, in stating at the Olympics, there is no separation between the United States and its historic client states and strategic allies within the region, Japan and South Korea, in terms of a unified posture against North Korea. What he was stating was absolutely backwards. It's not North Korea that is playing a wedge and dividing supposedly natural partners, the United States and South Korea. It's absolutely the United States which is driving a wedge between the two Koreas, and it's historically done so.
Well, the Korean War is kind of a lacuna in the U.S. public and media imagination. And I learned from the piece that you wrote in The Progressive, the long, dirty history of U.S. warmongering against North Korea, just how lasting and living the impact of that war is, and also that it was important as the beginning of the kind of big military money machinery, you know, post-World War II that we're seeing now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that you raise a really interesting point, and we can fast forward it to the present day. The Korean War, which ironically memorialized in the United States, is a forgotten war. But this is a war that was absolutely crucial in the post-1945 period. And let's remember that U.S. economy during World War II was geared toward total war. And the Korean War basically resuscitated an economy that was geared toward the production of permanent warfare. It was essential to establishing the national security state. It was absolutely essential to establishing what Chalmers Johnson has called an empire of bases around the world. And it put the United States on permanent war footing. If we flash forward to the current moment, we have Donald Trump, who states that he has an America First policy. And what he's doing right now, if you looked at the Nuclear Posture Review, the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review, it's completely geared toward revamping the U.S. nuclear weapons systems. And the United States possesses something like 7,000 nuclear warheads. North Korea has an estimated 10, and yet it claims that North Korea is some sort of existential threat to the United States. And the fact of the matter is that the revamping of the nuclear armaments industry, when the United States is, according to the NPT, supposed to actually start to dismantle its nuclear program, the fact of the matter is that's going to cost an estimated $1.7 trillion, and that's a low estimate. And so Donald Trump's America First policy is truly a military first policy, and that $1.7 trillion is $1.7 trillion that is taken away from any form of social program spending in this country. By contrast, even though Kim Jong-un's father actually had a military-first policy, it was the Songun policy, which was aimed at defending against the United States as the world's greatest military power. And as you mentioned, you know, Pence stating that North Korea is a threat has it absolutely wrong. The United States has leveled, since the middle part of the 20th century to the current moment, the most extreme sanctions packages against North Korea, which are aimed at collective punishment of the North Korean people. They're not aimed at a surgical strike against any kind of weapons industry within North Korea, and they're not aimed at the leadership. These sanctions include things like hospital equipment, any form of fuel, and they're aimed at harming the ordinary people. And the other things that the United States does, it conducts the largest war exercises in the world with its South Korean ally. These have been suspended because of the current Olympics and Paralympics that will follow. But these actually simulate the invasion and occupation of North Korea. They simulate the decapitation of the North Korean leadership, and they also simulate and rehearse a nuclear first strike against North Korea. So North Korea has been in the crosshairs of the U.S. war machine for decades. So Kim Jong-un's father had a military-first policy which is aimed at defending, at self-defense, defending North Korean society against the United States. What's interesting about Kim Jong-un is that his policy, the Byung-jin policy, is aimed at two simultaneous tracks. One is developing the nuclear weapons program of North Korea, but the other one is aimed at the economy, and it's aimed at improving the livelihood of the North Korean people. Can we say the same thing about Donald Trump?
Well, I often note how swallowing the double standard of U.S. exceptionalism is kind of the price of admission to serious foreign policy debate in the U.S. media. And, you know, we've also noted, though, how blithely U.S. politicians can refer to genocide on the Korean Peninsula without media raising an eyebrow. You know, John McCain told CNN's Jake Tapper last September, if Kim Jong-un acts in an aggressive fashion, he didn't even say what that meant, the price will be extinction. And Tapper just kept it moving. In your progressive piece, you say that this demonology script that we get from the media, that essentially means, and I want to use your words, we consent to North Korea's extinction in advance. I think that takes some sinking in, and that's media are playing a big role there.
You know, I would say, just to add to that, that Donald Trump, in making his first remarks before the United Nations, actually uttered that he was willing to totally destroy North Korea. Human rights scholars understood that as a statement of intention, which is absolutely essential for understanding the crime of genocide. North Korea is not new to fire and fury like the world has never seen, and actually experienced that at the hands of the United States in an asymmetrical war of intervention in the middle part of the 20th century that persists to this day. But that war actually resulted in an estimated 4 million Koreans dead, 70% of whom were civilians. And this is a war in which the United States had absolute mastery of the skies and contemplated using nuclear weapons against North Korea and China. So what you're actually raising right now is a really crucial point. A lot of times, especially the corporate media in the West, focuses on North Korean human rights violations, and they do so in a very jingoistic way, in paving the way for a war of humanitarian intervention, which, as we know, if we look at the examples of Libya and Iraq, actually only results in massive humanitarian catastrophe. The human rights narrative is skewed against North Korea when, in point of fact, the crime of crimes at Nuremberg was aggressive war. It was a war against the peace. And that is precisely what the Trump administration is gearing up to do against North Korea. And the people of both Koreas are not fooled. You know, Trump states that this could be somehow a kind of contained strike, that this bloody-nosed strike will only impact North Korea. Well, if he just looks at a map, if he just took a couple of minutes and stopped tweeting and looked at a map, he could actually see that Pyongyang is only 2 hours away by car from Seoul. And so any kind of supposedly limited action which involves tactical nuclear weapons that are about six times the magnitude of Hiroshima, in entertaining that as a possibility for the North, what the United States is actually doing is consenting also to the devastation of the South Korean people, and South Korea is ostensibly a U.S. ally. And so South Koreans are under no illusion. They understand that Donald Trump's anti-North Korean policy is actually an anti-Korean policy.
Well, finally, your piece cites General James Van Fleet, the commanding officer of U.N. forces in Korea, decades ago, who said there had to be a Korea either here or someplace in the world. The fact that what is today North Korea could tomorrow be, you know, East Asia, it brings me to the idea that what some people, and you've been talking about this, are fighting for is for war itself. And to me, that says we can fight for peace itself. even apart from any individual conflict, but certainly in this particular conflict. I wonder if you would talk about the possibilities for peace.
With the United States, in theory, within North Korean crosshairs, for the first time, we've seen, I think, a kind of mobilization and a sort of groundswell of peace activism, anti-war activism in the United States that's geared toward stopping Trump from going to war with North Korea. We've seen a number of even congressional figures introduce legislation that would limit Trump's capacity to, in a unilateral way, launch nuclear war. It's not that Trump is more jingoistic than Obama, for example, but his rhetoric is. And I think that what's interesting about this moment is in the illiberalism of Trump's, the sheer illiberalism, the overt illiberalism of his actions, finally we see a movement galvanizing on the ground for the United States not to go to war. It's not just that Koreans desire peace. I think that finally people in the United States, you know, who there are very few people with exception of figures like Paul Robeson who in the middle part of the 20th century actually argued that the United States had absolutely no right to go to war in Korea. And I think that finally now, belatedly, we're seeing people on the ground actually galvanizing for the possibility of peace in Korea, and it's all to the good.
We've been speaking with Christine Hong of the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the Korea Policy Institute. They're online at kpolicy.org. Christine Hong, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
A Senate committee led by Claire McGaskill has released a damning report on advocacy groups that get money from opioid makers and then advance opioid-friendly messaging. By aligning medical culture with industry goals, the report says, these groups, claiming to speak for people with pain, set the stage for the devastating opioid epidemic. Reporter Lee Fong was investigating that problem in 2016. We spoke to him in June of that year. In 2014, the class of drugs known as opioids were involved in more than 28,000 deaths, or 61% of all drug overdose deaths, according to the Centers for Disease Control. The rate of opioid overdoses has tripled since the year 2000. Recent data show two different but related trends. An increase in so-called illicit opioid overdoses, largely due to heroin, and then this 15-year increase in overdose deaths involving prescription opioid pain relievers. Those drugs, like oxycodone and hydrocodone, or brand names like OxyContin and Vicodin, account for more than 16,000 fatal overdoses each year. The CDC says they're comfortable using the term epidemic to describe the crisis. Pharmaceutical companies say they lament the addiction and fatality problems tied to their products, but they also seem determined to resist efforts to address them, suggesting to do so would have to mean taking away relief from people in pain. It's a medical story, certainly, but it's also one that calls for following the money, and that's what our guest does. Lee Fong is an investigative journalist whose work appears on The Intercept, among other places. He joins us now by phone from San Francisco. Welcome back to Counterspin, Lee Fong.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk a little about how we got here to an opioid crisis. Anytime a powerful drug exists, there's an opportunity for abuse, of course, but this isn't just a tragic tale of unintended consequence. There are some factors, aren't there, in how these particular drugs were introduced.
Right. For some of the bigger, well-known opioids, like OxyContin, manufactured by Purdue Pharma, these drugs were kind of rushed to market. There's evidence to suggest that early warning signs that showed how truly addictive OxyContin is were ignored in the approval process, and that the company did not really present evidence showing how dangerous and how likely patients were to overdose on OxyContin through the approval process. But the larger story of how we got to where we are today, where there's an epidemic that you referenced, not just from prescription opioids, but that the recent surge in heroin use and heroin overdoses is also linked to the prescription opioid industry. 4 out of 5 heroin users that started on opioid painkillers, many of those folks receiving those drugs just being prescribed by their doctors. And in America alone, about 81% of the global supply of oxycodone products and almost 100% of hydrocodone products such as Vicodin are used by Americans. So this is a uniquely American crisis. But to understand where we got to where we are today, it's really a marketing strategy that's been employed over the last 20, 25 years in which these pharmaceutical companies have pressured doctors, suppressed evidence, and they've coordinated a massive network of different foundations and medical societies to promote more use of these drugs for all kinds of different purposes, everything from minor tooth pain to minor back pain. There's clear evidence that the pharmaceutical companies are part and parcel to the recent surge we see in opioid use.
I want to just draw on one point that you just made. As you note, the Americans are 5% of the world's population, but we consume virtually all of the hydrocodone products like Vicodin and huge percentages of the oxycodone. And so you kind of have to ask, have other countries just not embraced the miracle? You know, they don't understand that this is a better mousetrap, you know, or maybe it comes down to marketing. And that brings us back to a company like Purdue Pharma that produced OxyContin for many years. And you talk about downplaying risks of addiction. I understand that they were sort of telling sales, I mean, not sort of, but telling their sales representatives to tell doctors that the risk of addiction was less than 1%. And it seems as though there was a gap between what they knew internally and what they were putting out to the public. And of course, that's what's so troubling to us, you know, is to know that a company can know something and yet regulators don't know it. And so, of course, the public doesn't know it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, this story is very similar to how, for example, tobacco companies use a vast political network and marketing strategy to push their product despite, you know, overwhelming science showing the health concerns of their product, or the oil industry using very sophisticated political strategies to suppress science. So for Purdue Pharma, they took a multi-pronged approach. In addition to kind of the typical pharmaceutical strategies, aggressively bringing on sales reps to push doctors to persuade them with different types of financial and other incentives to prescribe OxyContin and other opioids, and there was also kind of a more public-facing strategy where, you know, Purdue Pharma created a national network of different pain foundations. So these pain foundations would create marketing tools that would bring in people suffering from certain types of pain, from pain doctors, specialists, and pressure them to view opioids as the main type of recourse.
Right.
So between 1996 and 2002, Purdue Pharma funded more than 20,000 pain-related education programs, almost 10 a day, 7 days a week. During that time, Purdue conducted more than 40 national pain management training conferences in vacation spots like Boca Raton and Scottsdale, paying for more than 5,000 physicians to attend. And they also helped create and fund specialty centers, like Academy for Pain Sciences, that would take doctors and give them all types of materials and prescribing guidelines to encourage the use of OxyContin and other opioids. And for certain areas of the country, they even created specialized regional pain foundations that would market the drug. So the Appalachian Pain Foundation, based in West Virginia, they were well-funded by Purdue Pharma and arranged meetings between doctors and local reporters. There's also evidence to suggest that Purdue Pharma and other pain companies would coordinate grassroots networks of pain patients. So when reporters would write stories saying there's this growing opioid epidemic, there are these problems with addiction, they would coordinate to send angry emails to reporters and claim that they were being stigmatized unfairly, to push back against reporters and editors we're starting to peek around and look at this type of dynamic.
Right. And of course, the reason that that would have resonance is that there was a moment in which it was understood that pain was undertreated. And, you know, there are people who have severe pain and who want it to be taken seriously. And none of this is to undermine the situation that those people face, you know. But that's why that kind of narrative that claims to harness a grassroots voice or a voice of patients, particularly patients in pain, can be very persuasive. And yet you kind of get the story or another aspect of it from the fact that Purdue, for example, the makers of OxyContin, they're saying that they're patient advocates, but when patients get together, like some in Ohio did, to have a class action to say that they'd become addicted to OxyContin, well, then Purdue wants to block that.
Right. Like for any grassroots lobbying campaign, they seized on a legitimate grievance, and that's the undertreatment of some pain conditions, and they layered on some untrue claims, such as these guidelines and these marketing materials that claimed that opioids were not addictive or were not at high risk of addiction. And they organized individuals and these kind of very PR-savvy foundations to push this false claim.
That was reporter Lee Fong on Counterspin in 2016. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them and their transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
If we clean up air pollution, the weather gets hotter and wilder. From Norway, Dr. Bjorn Hamset explains the stakes. Then from Harvard, Dr. Francesca Domenici reveals shocking new science. Just a short exposure to bad air kills seniors. I'm Alex. This is Radio EcoShock, clearing the air.
Radio EcoShock.
We all know air pollution is killing millions of people around the world. Nobody likes smog. But what happens if we clean it up? If electric cars reduce carbon pollution, if governments finally act to stop climate change gases, well, we get hotter. In fact, new science suggests the initial burst of heating from cleaner air could come close, in the worst-case scenario anyway, to the amount of warming we've already experienced. We'll talk about that, because here to explain is Dr. Bjorn Halvard Samset. He is the research director at CICERO, the Center for International Climate and Environmental Research, that's in Norway. Bjorn is a physicist. He's widely versed in climate science. He's often quoted in Norwegian media. And Bjorn specializes in extreme precipitation and the role of atmospheric aerosols in a changing climate. The new paper, Climate Impacts from a Removal of Anthropogenic Aerosol Emissions, was published in January 2018 in Geophysical Research Letters. Bjorn Samset, a warm welcome for Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Several years ago, Dr. James Hansen, the former head of NASA's Goddard Space Center, he warned more of a degree of heating is in the pipeline, as he called it, and that sort of delayed responses to emissions already in the atmosphere. Is that what this paper set out to test? How does this relate to Hansen's in-the-pipeline theory?
Well, they're actually two quite separate concepts. The idea of Hansen's paper is really this thermostat. I mean, imagine you have your house, you have a new wonderful house, you know there's a thermostat on the wall, and you want it to get a little bit warmer. So you turn your thermostat up, say, one or two notches. That's what we've done with CO2. We've turned the thermostat of the Earth up a couple of notches, but how warm does it get and how long does that take? So in your house, you're going to have to wait maybe a couple of hours for the thing to actually heat up. On the Earth, we really don't know how far we've gotten in this heating so far. So we, in climate change terms, we don't know the energy imbalance of the Earth. We've started accumulating more energy because of all this extra greenhouse gas. We don't know how far that heating has gotten. So that's more what James Hansen was getting at. In this new paper, we are working on something else that James Hansen has also been kind of warning about, and that's that there's a separate climate impact or impact of our anthropogenic emissions. Those are from aerosols, which work, at least most of the aerosols, they're small particles suspended in the atmosphere, basically dust. They work completely counter to greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases act by trapping heat from the atmosphere, retaining it in the atmosphere for somewhat longer than they would otherwise have done before they escaped to space. Aerosols, they reflect sunlight as it comes back in. So they're basically miniature mirrors floating around in the atmosphere. They reflect back the sunlight, which will, as you can guess, cool the Earth. So that's a slightly different thing, but they are about of the same magnitude, these two effects. That's true.
Can you give us a brief introduction to some of the aerosols that your group studied?
Yeah, well, aerosols, that's basically everything that's of a relatively small, 1 micrometer about size in the atmosphere. So if you have dust in your yard and wind blows it up into the air, that's one type of aerosol. Sea spray is another type of aerosol. Those are the natural types. They've always been there. They always will be. But then our industrial activities, and in particular our use of fossil fuels, they've added some new types of aerosols. In particular, one of them is sulfate. So basically sulfur compounds that they're emitted as just small chemical compounds, but then in the atmosphere through various processes, they grow to larger sizes. And once they have reached a certain particle size, they can actually, water can condense onto these things. They become small, basically small water droplets with a small sulfate nucleus in the middle. And these things, they can then start reflecting sunlight. So sulfate is one thing. Another one is black carbon or various compounds of carbon that you get when you have incomplete combustion. So you burn some wood in your yard, you're going to see all the smoke coming up. That's a combination of various types of carbon. But the blackest of that, which is this black stuff that comes out of a dirty diesel engine, for instance, if you don't have a good particle filter on there, a lot of black smoke is going to come out. That really black smoke, that's black carbon. There's actually quite a lot of that being emitted from diesel cars, from coal fire plants, etc. Around the world every year. So these are kind of the two main aerosol types that we studied. We also looked at a little bit at what's called organic carbon, which is the rest of the stuff that comes out of wood smoke. That seems to have a smaller effect. It's really the sulfate and the black carbon. Those are the two main aerosol types from our pollution that we consider.
Why did your team think it was important to find out how much cooling we're getting from this pollution and what would happen if we managed to stop?
Well, we know that air pollution, as you said in the introduction, it's obviously a bad thing. It's killing a lot of people. It's something that we really want to clean up. And in parts of the world, in Europe and in the U.S., we've had the various versions of the Clean Air Acts. We really have cleaned up our act, as it were. There's a lot less air pollution here than there's been before. So we know that can be done technically, and we also know it probably will be done for health reasons. Now, the main aerosol pollution today is in other parts of the world. There's a lot in some in Africa, some in the Middle East, but quite a lot over in South Asia, India and China. They have quite a lot of it. You know, if you've been to Beijing or Delhi or any of these cities, they really have issues with air pollution, which they obviously are trying to tackle. So whatever we do with greenhouse gas emissions, this aerosol pollution is going to get cleaned up for other reasons. So in particular, now that we have the Paris Agreement and we've decided to stay within 2 degrees of global warming, maybe even 1.5 degrees, it gets really relevant. Those are to say, well, 2 degrees is a lot of warming, but still relative to what we were warning about just a few years back, which was 4 or 5 degrees warming by the year 2100, then this is actually relatively moderate, which means that this aerosol perturbation or the effect of cleaning up air pollution is not just a small effect anymore. It's a relatively significant thing. So if you do the sensible thing and clean up our air, one thing, the world as a whole gets warmer, so it makes it harder to reach the Paris target. We've known this for a long, long time, so that part is not a surprise. It's baked into all the scenarios. But what is somewhat difficult to assess is the regional effect of this, because as I said, most of the aerosols currently come from Southeast Asia. That means that the big effect is really there, because if you emit CO2 or even methane, these greenhouse gases, they get transported for quite some time in the atmosphere. So they distribute pretty well throughout the entire global atmosphere. The CO2 concentration where I'm sitting is the same as where you're sitting, basically wherever we are. But the aerosol concentration is not. The aerosols only stay in the air for a couple of days, 3, 4, 5 days maybe at the most, which means they don't travel very far. So when I say that, well, the aerosols, if you remove all the aerosols, it might heat the world by 0.5 degree or maybe even 1 degree if we're unlucky. That hides a big effect, that most of this global mean effect is actually concentrated around South Asia. That's the part of the world that's going to get the biggest effect, both on heating, and then as you lose the aerosol heating, then the surface of East Asia is going to heat quite a lot. That affects precipitation, that affects extreme rainfall, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to have a large climate impact. So that's really what we were getting at, trying to find this regional distribution of what's going to happen if you do clean up the aerosols.
If I understood your results correctly, you offer a range of between 0.5 degree C warming and 1.1 degree C warming are possible without that air pollution being there. How did you arrive at the lower number, the 0.5 degree C warming? What has to happen for us to have less of an effect?
Well, let me just say that for this research, we did what we often do in climate science. We took the climate models and we gave them as big a kick as you can. So it's in this sense, we checked what's the impact of really removing all of our aerosol emissions, all of our sulfate emissions from our industry, all the black carbon emissions, and also a lot of the organic carbon, which means that we would have to cut a lot of the biomass burning, which comes from cooking, etc. That's not in any way realistic, just like cutting all greenhouse gases is unfortunately not realistic for quite some time. So this is really an upper limit. It's really seeing how big of an effect are we really having on the climate. But this range is because we ran 4 different climate models from 4 groups around the world, so 4 really fundamentally different models with different processes. They're state-of-the-art models run at relatively high resolution, so it's kind of the same models that were used for the previous IPCC report, for instance. So they're relatively up-to-date models. But as you then mentioned, they give relatively different answers, even though we changed the conditions in the model in precisely the same way. And most of that difference really lies in our uncertainty about how aerosols affect clouds. Clouds are a really important player in the energy balance of the Earth. And what happens when you put a lot of aerosols into a cloud? Well, the amount of water in the cloud is not going to change. The water is just there. But this water can condense onto more small particles, which means that the water gets distributed run more, into more smaller droplets, which makes the cloud whiter, so it reflects more sunlight. So this, when we call it the indirect effect of aerosols. And the aerosol itself has a direct effect. That's this little mirror effect of it reflecting sunlight, or even capturing sunlight in the case of black carbon. That's a direct effect, but then this effect on clouds is an indirect effect. And one of the reasons that we chose this particular set of models, or it turned out to be a good choice, because one of them we know has a relatively weak indirect effect, or a weak effect of aerosols on clouds, whereas another one has a relatively strong one. So this span between a half degree and just above 1 degree of warming from removing all aerosols really comes from us not knowing very well what happens when aerosols get put into a cloud.
Yes, clouds remain one of the mystery regions that science is still exploring. Now, you mentioned that water vapor requires particles in the air to become raindrops, so to speak, or snow if it's cold enough. I'm wondering, oddball question, does it follow there might be fewer extreme precipitation events in the future hitting big cities if the air is substantially cleaned up because there'd be fewer particles?
Yes, that could follow. That is one hypothesis that's being checked out. Though there are other impacts as well from either cooling or heating the surface, because aerosols might actually reduce the impact of this urban heat island effect. So cities being hotter than the area around. We're guessing that affects extreme precipitation, though we really don't have a good answer to that. It's actually being investigated back at Cicero, where I work, in another project. And I know other groups around the world are working on the same thing. And again, just to add to all this fun complexity of the aerosols, it depends on what kind of aerosol you're talking about, because the sulfate aerosols, they will act on clouds like we've been talking about, making those droplets smaller. So yes, that could affect the extreme rainfall rates. Then if your aerosols are black carbon instead, then they will capture the sunlight as they are, or when they're flying around high in the atmosphere, which will heat the atmosphere above the ground, so higher up, so that affects the whole convection pattern, the whole heating pattern of the atmosphere. It changes precipitation or rainfall in different ways again. So aerosols are, I mean, for scientists, they're wonderful to study because they're so complex. There's so many different ways they can interact with the climate. But if you're looking for a straight answer for what is the impact of aerosols on rainfall or extreme rainfall, it's horrendously difficult to get at. So we're working on that one.
Okay. Well, in this paper, you and your co-authors say, quote, "We find a higher sensitivity of extreme events to aerosol reductions per degree of surface warming, in particular over the major aerosol emission regions." What is that process? How can cleaner air pump up warming into more extreme events?
Well, it turns out that's most likely a two-stage effect. At least that's what it looks like in the models. First of all, the effect is that when you have a lot of aerosols, say over parts of East Asia, let's say China, for instance, which is currently really cleaning up its aerosol pollution, they've had a lot of aerosols. This has been cooling the surface somewhat. Now, remove these aerosols, you're going to get a lot of surface heating there. And surface heating leads to the warmer air aloft as well, so it leads to more precipitation. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing is that extreme precipitation, extreme rainfall, if you heat the earth just through global warming or any process, then extreme rainfall will increase faster than average rainfall. This is due to the availability of moisture and also availability of energy in the atmosphere. So it all comes down to the energy balance of the atmosphere, because it takes a lot of energy to generate this big average precipitation. But whereas while we feel the extreme rainfall more, it actually takes less energy because there are fewer of these extreme events. So this has been seen both in observations and also in theory, that we know it theoretically why it happens, that extreme rainfall increases faster than average rainfall. So when you combine these effects, you see that regionally, the ground heats faster because the aerosols are located in one specific region, and then the extreme rainfall increases faster than the average rainfall again. So this is a double effect.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the Center for International Climate and Environmental Research in Oslo, Norway. We are talking with Dr. Bjørn Hamset. He's co-author of a new paper explaining that cleaner air could become hotter air. I'm wondering, does the reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change include this expected heating from reduced air pollution, as reported in your new paper, when they put out projections that they call their representative pathways?
They do, to some extent. The reduction in aerosols that we expect in the future because of health concerns and also because when you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you reduce use of fossil fuel and that cleans up aerosols as well. That part is included. But these representative concentration pathways, they tend to have pretty similar reduction pathways for the aerosols. They don't really span the opportunity space. And for health reasons, you can certainly imagine that countries like China and India will want a relatively fast aerosol cleanup if they can. And it looks like China, for instance, certainly can. They are actively reducing their pollution at the moment. And what is then not really well studied in any of these scenarios is what we were trying to get at in our paper, which is this regional distribution. So trying to understand difference in impact of climate change in different parts of the world, if you have different balances between greenhouse gases and aerosols. You have to remember that the last IPCC report was really trying to warn about these business as usual RCP 8.5 scenarios, which is really emit as much as we can for a long time. So really the high end of possible global warming. Even in 2013, when that last Working Group 1 report, so the natural science part of the IPCC report, came out, this was almost seen as the most probable outcome because there had been no reduction whatsoever of greenhouse gases at all. And this 2-degree scenario was seen as unrealistically low. We would never get there. What has happened in the meantime is that we've had the Paris Agreement. Businesses, industries around the world really started taking climate change seriously. So even though we haven't really started reducing emissions yet, there's a mentality that wasn't there even just a few years back. So things are really happening. So it looks like there's going to be a big drive towards getting to these lower end of global warming. But that makes the aerosols, again, much, much more important. They were seen as a minor perturbation in the last IPCC report, in the sense that they have their whole chapter of their own, aerosols and clouds. I was contributing to that chapter as well, so we certainly did the work properly, and they're very well treated. But still, one saw, rightly, the greenhouse gas emissions. That was the main issue. But now that we are getting momentum behind reducing greenhouse gases, suddenly aerosols start to matter more again. So probably in the next IPCC cycle, we'll have even more focus on different pathways that aerosol mitigation can take.
I'm really interested in your work on regional climate change because it shows how far we've come. A couple of decades ago, all we could talk about was global climate change, and there's been a lot of work by scientists to try and narrow this down and get the regional work in. And I'm thinking of the earlier paper you co-authored in 2016. It's titled Regional and Seasonal Radiative Forcing by Perturbations to Aerosol and Ozone Precursor Emissions. And that paper suggested a way to time the release of pollution to improve air quality without losing the cooling shield of different aerosols. Here's what you said. For example, reducing summertime emissions of black carbon and wintertime emissions of sulfur dioxide in the more polluted regions is a possible way to improve air quality without weakening the negative radiative forcing of aerosols. Bjorn, can you give us an example of how that could work?
The thing is that aerosols, they have different ways of interacting with the climate. One we've already covered quite extensively, it's interaction with clouds. So imagine you release sulfate aerosols, but you do it in a cloud-free environment, then that effect is really not going to matter. But if you do it at a time of the year when there's a lot of clouds, then it's going to matter a lot more. So if you time your mitigation to be parts of the year that have a lot of clouds or parts that don't have so much cloud, then you can modulate. You can still keep the cooling while fixing the air pollution for at least certain parts of the year. Black carbon, on the other hand, its climate impact becomes stronger the whiter the surface beneath it becomes. So it kind of gets a double effect because the white, it captures sunlight coming in, but if the sunlight misses the black carbon, it hits the earth and the surface is white, then the sunlight gets reflected back up and then it can hit the black carbon going back up again. So it has a double chance of interacting with solar radiation. So for, well, up where I live in Norway, we have a lot of snow now. So everything is white. So black carbon is going to have a big effect now, whereas in summer, it's a lot darker. We have a lot of dark forests and trees, so it's not going to matter all that much. So you can do things like this. You can do kind of clever timing of your mitigation. Though I have to say, it was suggested that you could do something like that, but it's something that would probably be very difficult in actual practice. But it's an example of the kind of thinking that we might need if it turns out that the impacts of climate change are so severe that we really, really, really do not want to go above 2 degrees. And at the same time, you see that air pollution is so bad that it kills so many people that we really, really have to clean up. Then maybe things like this could be ideas, could be ways of arranging it for ourselves so we can hit both targets at once.
As you've said, we know heavily populated regions like New England to some degree, but definitely Shanghai and Delhi, have their own dome of particulates above them. And I'm wondering, does that mean that swings in heat and precipitation and extreme weather could be larger above megacities as aerosols are reduced?
Yes, it does mean that. The aerosols are part of this complex interaction between solar radiation and surface heating, moisture, latent heating, all these effects that act together to produce the microclimates around the big cities. And in extremely polluted cases, you know aerosols are going to be a major player. So the climate around, say, a totally clean Beijing or clean Delhi is of course going to be fundamentally different from the climate around a polluted city. When it is polluted, it's this pollution that you notice first. So of course you want to get rid of the air pollution, have a clean air city. But on average, you're going to experience then differences in long-term rainfall rates and probably also even extreme rainfall. But how that effect plays out is really going to be extremely local. There we have to go in with regional climate modeling, even weather prediction style calculations for each specific region. That's a tough challenge, but probably should be done for each city where this is relevant, just so you can actually prepare for the climate that is coming after the aerosol cleanup.
I'm wondering if our current path of warming may become so steep and so serious that somewhere a worried scientist might advise top politicians, we can't afford any more legislation to clean up the air right now due to increased heating. And I know President Trump would accept that scientific advice. Is it possible?
Well, I've seen scientists say a lot of strange things. So anything is possible. I would hope that no one does say that, though, of course, it's what you advise someone is always going to be a balance. It would certainly not be be my advice, and I certainly know that our concern for human health and just the lungs of our children, if you will, tends to be a lot higher than climate. So our concern for the climate. So I would guessing it would rather be the other way around, that we have to spend as much money as we can on cleaning up air pollution, and then we can do greenhouse gas emissions next, which is then also problematic in this case, because this extra heating that you would get from removing air pollution, really, its really only main message is that, well, we have to be even tougher on greenhouse gas emissions at the same time as cleaning up the air.
Well, I agree. I think this paper definitely means we need a new way forward. We need to educate and warn the public, and they should understand that a smaller warming due to cleaner air with any disruption, that's not a failure. It's just a price we have to pay for past atmospheric carbon dumping. What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, this is just like really the whole climate change issue. I mean, it's not it's not something previous generations did to us out of malice, right? It's a situation we put ourselves in because we wanted to create a better society for climate change or the use of fossil fuels. We did this by exploiting the energy reserve that suddenly became available to us. Fossil fuels are wonderful, right? They've given us the society that we live in. But then it turns out they have this side effect of causing a hotter climate, which we're now realizing that we really have to deal with, and we have to do it fast. And we've kind of backed ourselves into a corner because we have so much use for fossil fuels. Now, all these same processes, they are also emitting aerosols. That's a second effect. It's also there. Again, it's not there by malice. It kind of just happened as we go along. But now we're realizing that we have this double, I usually call it a tug of war between the heating from greenhouse gases and the cooling from aerosols. We're trying to get a handle on which side has been winning that tug of war, but both the effects are there, and we just have to deal with them.
We've been speaking with Dr. Bjørn Halvard Samset. He's the research director at the Center for International Climate and Environmental Research in Oslo, Norway. Bjørn is co-author of a new paper warning a cleanup of air pollution could reveal serious warming already hidden in the system. You can find the full paper free online at the Journal for Geophysical Research Letters and find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Bjørn, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks for talking with me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. If you thought air pollution was cleaned up and regulated for safety by the government, listen up. Smog continues to kill thousands of Americans and likely millions of others around the world every year. But who? And how can we save lives? And what can you learn to protect your own? A massive study from Harvard University adds a surprising new twist. For American seniors, just a short-term exposure to air pollution drives up deaths for the next 2 days. The title is Association of Short-Term Exposure to Air Pollution with Mortality in Older Adults. It was published by the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA. Our guest, Francesca Domenici, is co-author. Educated in Italy, she's been applying statistics to public health problems at Johns Hopkins University and more recently at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, where she is professor of biostatistics. Last March, Domenici became co-leader of a major project called the Harvard Data Science Initiative. Francesca, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I try to keep cool and science-minded, but I admit when I look into lives lost to pollution, I get a little upset. We could save a lot of lives that do matter by warning people that are at risk and cleaning up the air a little bit more. What do you think?
Yes, that's correct. We are now pretty confident, not only through this study that I have led, but through many other studies around the world, that still short-term exposure to fine particulate matter and ozone, even a level below of safety standards, are harmful to human health and increase the risk of deaths for people older than 65.
Were you able to find a threshold where these small particles are all right for you?
No. And that was actually one of the key findings of this study. What was very unique about these studies was that for the first time, we used data from satellite, so then we could estimate exposure to pollution at levels that are very, very low and below the national ambient air quality standards that are set by the Environmental Protection Agency here in the U.S. And this has never been done before with the level of accuracy. Before, most of the epidemiological studies have estimated mortality risk associated with exposure of pollution only in very urban areas, which are the areas that are monitored by the EPA. So in any case, by being able to estimate exposure to pollution in more rural area, in an area where the level are very low, for the first time we were able to estimate the risk of mortality for levels that are below the standards. Because we did the study for million of U.S. citizens, actually for 97% of the whole population in the United States, we had a higher level of accuracy in trying to understand whether or not a safe level exists. And actually, it doesn't, which really what it's telling is that we really need to reduce ambient exposure to fine particulate matter as much as possible.
Yes, there's data, and then there is stupendous mega data. I mean, you covered 12 years, millions and millions of Americans, every zip code. How can you possibly manipulate that much data and come out with something?
Well, I love this question because I am a data scientist, and this is really my passion. Well, you know, of course, I assemble a fantastic team of data scientists that I could by no means do this all by myself. We linked claims data from Medicare for over 12 years with estimated exposure to pollution, as I said, using satellite data and data from the EPA for every zip code in the United States for every day for the last 12 years. Yes, this is a massive amount of data. Just to give you a sense, this was we analyzed 460 million records. How did we do it? Well, it's a mix of highly sophisticated computational approaches that we learned from the computer scientists, together with literally taking over all the entire Harvard supercomputer. We did have an ask to dedicate to these studies all of the computers at Harvard. We use Harvard, you know, we use a secure server system. And so we literally were the only one at Harvard at some point that were using the entire computing power of the university.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
That's saying something.
Well, also, you know, I should say that the only time we could do that was on Christmas Eve and on July 4th because, you know, everyone else was on holiday. So.
And you were hard at work. Well, let's say one fine Monday in May, we wake up and the pollution is up. Maybe the news mentions it. We see a brownish haze. We go out anyway. What did your study find out about deaths within the next 2 days or so?
Yeah, what we found is that even for this actually small increase of fine particulate matter, so let's say just one unit increase in the level of fine particulate matter from the day to the next. What we found is for one unit increase in ambient fine particulate matter from one day to the next, which is a small, tiny increase, by the way. It's not something that you will notice. A big increase is a 10 microgram per cubic meter. So for a small, even for a small increase, every time you've seen a small increase from one day to the next of one unit in fine particulate matter, we will estimate an excess of 500 extra deaths per year every time that this happens. So in general, just think about, you know, in a ballpark number, we did say that on average, you will get, for every time there is a little bit increase in fine particulate matter, thousands, up to 20,000 senior citizens will die every year. And, you know, we're pretty confident about these fundings right now. And even, you know, in terms of how precise these estimates are. And so it is like if someone would say to the public, look, we know that very often we might have a situation where over 20,000 citizens, senior citizens in America will die per year. I'm pretty sure that, you know, if that was a terrorist attack or was any other factor, people will intervene pretty quickly. In this situation, this is something that's happening when at the same time, unfortunately, we're seeing a tremendous amount of evidence that the current government is shutting down the Environmental Protection Agency and the science around the EPA.
Well, I want to get into that more a little bit later, but the first is something that kind of shocked me about this study, something I have to grasp with, and that is, I presume that air pollution was like smoking cigarettes, kind of a cumulative effect over years, but it seems like you're saying even one bad air day can bring an earlier death.
Yes, so that's true. We published a different study back in June, that's June in the New England Journal of Medicine. That study used a similar amount of data to provide evidence that long-term exposure, cumulative exposure to air pollution increases mortality risk. And so that is the type of chronic exposure like the one that you're mentioning in the context of, you know, chronic exposure of cigarette smoking. This particular study is different, and you're exactly right in terms of that, in a certain way, a little bit more surprising, because what we are studying are short-term effects. And so what we are studying is whether day-to-day changes in ambient exposure to pollution. So if you had an increase in exposure from pollution from yesterday to tomorrow, do we see in the same geographical location a day-to-day changes in mortality risk? And the answer is yes. And that's what it's telling us, is that ambient exposure to pollution does not only affect mortality and, by the way, many other adverse health outcomes chronically, but also as an acute effect.
And I've looked at photographs from a microscope of these tiny particles. They're not like just a bit of dust or a bit of sand necessarily. After they flow through city air, they look more like little asteroids coated with pesticides and heavy metals. Is it true that some below a certain size cannot be filtered out by the body and just go straight past our defenses into the lungs and maybe the bloodstream?
Yes, that's exactly right. Originally, years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency was regulating total suspended particles. There were much larger particle sizes. Then they transitioned into regulating PM10, which was particulate matter of a diameter of less than 10 microns. Now they're regulating PM2.5, which is particulate matter of a diameter size less than 2.5 microns. Now, these are called fine particulate matters. The reason why they're called fine particulate matters is that they penetrate deep into the lung, and now there is in a lot of evidence, both from biological studies, studying in vivo, studying in vitro, but also from other animal studies, that by fine particulate matter, by penetrating deep into the lung, start and quite drastic inflammation system, which could affect our heart and our lungs. These are fine particulate matter in a way that you don't filter out by coughing. So, for example, if you're driving in a very dusty area or there is a construction, you tend, or if you, you know, your eyes are sort of burning a little bit. These are not the fine particulate matter. These are called coarse particulate matter, are bigger in size, and so then you tend to filter out, which is also what is a little worrisome about the fine particulate matter, that is not something that you experience. You don't know whether or not you're breathing, or you tend not to notice whether or not you're breathing higher level of fine particulate matter.
And they can come right through the walls into the building. We could be breathing them right now. We probably are.
Exactly, exactly. Differently from ozone, ozone is a different type of pollutant, and it has a hard time to penetrate into the indoor. But actually, we have also a lot of evidence that indoor PM2.5 is higher than the outdoor PM2.5, because you have both the part of the outdoor of PM2.5 that comes inside, plus some sources of fine particulate matter that comes from the inside.
Were you able to determine in this study, or have you heard from other studies, how these two pollutants affect, say, African Americans more or Hispanics more or poorer people? Is there a breakdown below the big numbers?
Yes, many of my colleagues around the world have been providing evidence that indeed and unfortunately the most vulnerable, both in terms of socioeconomic status, in terms of access of healthcare, in terms of having other type of comorbidity, tend to have a higher risk of mortality associated with fine particulate matter. There have been extensive studies all around the world in developing countries. The effect for fine particulate matter is devastating, especially in India and China, also because the levels in this country tend to be extremely high. In our country, in the United States in particular, both this study that we're just publishing and the study that we published in last summer, again, because we were able to rigorously study the entire U.S. population, we estimate the mortality risk associated with short and long-term exposure for people of color and for people that are at lower socioeconomic status. So we measured that because we knew from claims data the people that enroll in Medicaid, and it's very well known that people that are eligible to the Medicaid system, they have lower income. And both in the context of mortality risk associated with chronic exposure to pollution and mortality risk associated with short-term exposure of pollution, we did find that people of low income and Black in particular have much, much higher risk.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest from the Harvard School of Public Health is Professor Francesca Domenici. We're talking about how even a short burst of pollution kills thousands of Americans every year. I know that you think it's important to get the word about this out there, or you wouldn't be on this program. Don't you think seniors and activists need to hear about this science? I mean, way beyond the medical journals, which incidentally are hidden behind copyright walls.
Yes, I mean, that for sure. I mean, I think that as a scientist, my main responsibility is to do high rigorous science, provide the best possible evidence, and trying to publish my science to the top medical journal where, to the degree that they can, they highly scrutinize the quality of the science that we produce through the peer review system. And then we go to press release and we talk to people like you to disseminate the evidence. But I do think it's extremely important that the American people understand the science, understand the implication of what we are publishing, because ultimately it is a responsibility of the government to making sure that we can breathe clean air. Keep in mind that differently from other type of public health risk factor, let's say smoking or stay away from fatty food, don't eat potato fries, lose weight. To a certain degree, in this context, people can have control or make choices about quit smoking and deciding to have a healthier lifestyle. In the context of breathing fine particulate matter, I mean, it's not that you can stop breathing, right? So it's not that you can try to move every time in a different location where you think the level of pollution are lower. So it is really a responsibility of the government in trying to assure that we can breathe clean air, not only for the senior citizen, but especially for the kids and the children. By the way, not my own research, but colleagues of mine, University of Southern California, have done fantastic studies years ago that published in New England Journal of Medicine, where they've shown that kids that were in breathing air pollution have compromised pulmonary function. And so this is kids where ultimately their pulmonary function is going to get compromised for the rest of their life. So this is serious stuff.
Now, the United States is lucky under the Clean Air Act to have the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, and those are modified from time to time as new science like yours comes out. Where are we in that process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Clean Air Act, which was, I would say, a fantastic victory in a certain way toward reducing ambient level of pollution. I mean, since the Clean Air Act passed in the 70s and through the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, if anyone is curious to see the ambient level of pollution in this country, they have been going down over time. And, you know, in a certain way, has been a beautiful example of setting a law, setting safety standards, looking at the evidence, reviewing the scientific evidence, and keep lowering the level. So I have to say, on a positive note, we have done, through a responsible government, through the EPA, and through the science, a fantastic job in cleaning up the air. However, I do think that we're not done yet. I do think that what we wanted to do with this study and with the reason why we gathered an enormous amount of data was really to see as whether the job of cleaning up the air was done or not. And even when I take this enormous study population and I only look at mortality risk associated with exposure of pollution in areas that are always below the National Ambient Air Quality Standard. So I always look at senior citizens that always live in clean area, right? So these are people that are always in compliance. Still, we see an increase in mortality risk. So I think the bottom line is the Clean Air Act, setting National Ambient Air Quality Standard, the review of the scientific evidence by the EPA, I think has been a fantastic example of how we've been cleaning up our air, but we're not done yet.
Before we go, the Harvard Data Science Initiative, that looks very promising. What is the goal there?
Oh, yeah, I'm actually glad you asked me this. So the Harvard Data Science Initiative is a university-wide initiative, has been created and funded initially by the Provost, our Provost Alan Garber. The idea is the following, not all in the context of environmental health, but in the context of all the major scientific disciplines, ranging from astronomy, ranging from medicine, personalized medicine, the public health, the economy, in social sciences. In any single discipline, we now know that we can make enormous progress in understanding and answering important scientific questions through data. Now we have available all the new type of data, data from satellite, data from cell phone, data from sensor. And so the goal of the Data Science Initiative, which we hope to become a Harvard Data Science Institute, is to bring together the best minds at Harvard that can use the best possible data to unlock important scientific questions. And this study is one example. It's an example of taking massive amount of data, by the way, all from government sources, from satellite, from temperature, from monitoring network, from claims data, from Medicare, and to unlock important question, which in this context is, does the current level of ambient air pollution still killing us?
What will you be working on next?
Well, so many different things. One is in my role as one of the director of the Harvard Data Science Initiative. I literally try to better understand all of the different data science around Harvard so then I can empower many of my colleagues to find better treatment for cancer, to identify social injustice, to better understand the economic factors, to better understand digital economy, and so on. So I have an important role as a director of the Data Science Initiative together with my colleague and the other co-director, David Parks, who is a professor of computer science at Harvard University. Then I will continue to conduct studies in the context of environmental health, not only in terms of providing epidemiological evidence about health effects of air pollution, but more importantly, in terms of understanding and providing evidence of what can we do about it, what type of regulatory intervention could allow to reduce exposure to pollution in a cost-effective manner. I am also fundamentally a data scientist and a methodologist, so I develop statistical methodology to extract useful information from messy data. And that is really important because one pattern that's happening right now with all of this data and with all of these buzz, you know, through machine learning and artificial intelligence, I think we still need to keep in mind that having a lot of data without principled way of analyzing this data, we can get a lot of confusion and not a lot of information. And finally, you know, I am a professor, so I mentor students, I mentor postdoctoral fellow, I teach classes.
Sounds like a busy life, all right. From the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, we've been speaking with Dr. Francesca Domenici. As a professor of biostatistics, she's co-authored the paper Association of Short-Term Exposure to Air Pollution with Mortality in Older Adults. These are your doctors talking, people, so we want to listen to that. You can find more links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Francesca, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're very welcome, Alex. Thank you so much for covering this important science and for having me at the show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In our short time remaining, here is a brief clip from early Radio EcoShock. On February 9th, 2006, my show, The Polluted Womb, reported that air pollution enters the womb and can change the DNA of babies and future health for a lifetime. Here is a clip, and I'll repost the full piece in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
A report from Radio EcoShock.
I think you're all aware that asthma rates in children have increased dramatically in recent years. There's been a reported doubling in incidence rates in the last 20 years. And a recent study confirmed that 25% of elementary school children in Harlem had asthma. And developmental problems have also been increasing, even accounting for improved diagnosis. Rates of learning disabilities, ADHD, and autism have increased, and an estimated 15% of elementary or school children in the U.S. have at least one learning disability.
That's right. Classrooms full of wheezing kids with inhalers in their pockets. Postmodern kids have damaged DNA and diminished IQ because chemicals are hitting them right in the womb in their earliest stages of development. Okay, this is last year's news, but the horror of industrial damage to our new generation of humans hasn't really reached us. We definitely don't want to hear that our air, seeming so clear, is poisonous. And our vehicles, those magic things that let us fly across the ground, reach right into the womb and our lungs ever after. A team of researchers led by Dr. Frederica Pereira has proven this with a groundbreaking study in New York City. The team from Columbia University followed hundreds of mothers from the first discovery of pregnancy through infancy and early childhood. One of the most important discoveries? Pesticides and other industrial chemicals are mixing with car exhaust, a kind of unseen toxic smog that penetrates the womb and harms humans at every stage of life. Pesticides cause birth defects, damage DNA, and predispose children to diseases later in life, especially cancer. We know this by science and by the sick and dying people exposed to pesticides. Of course, you don't use pesticides, just Mother Nature brand soap in your home, so you're okay, right? Not really. As Dr. Pereira describes in a 40-minute speech given to congressional staffers, pesticides are everywhere. Municipalities spray them along roads to kill weeds and trees. Condo and apartment maintenance people use them liberally. Golf course spray adds to the aerosol mist of chlorinated poisons that float across the city. And your factory farm food is laced with fungicides, insecticides, and herbicides. Blood tests of random citizens, whether in Europe or North America, reveal 60 or more toxic chemicals running around in all of us. Trust me, you're getting your fair share of the chemical feast.
I've got mercury, lead, arsenic. I've got flame retardants. I've got the stain repellent. I've got PCBs. I've got pesticides. I've got insecticides. So, you know, digesting that and then thinking, well, these are carcinogens, these are toxins that are in me, and then thinking that we only tested for 88. So I have to just extrapolate that and think there are hundreds more in me, and there are hundreds more in everybody. You burst the bubble of denial pretty quickly.
The biggest non-surprise? Automobile smog combined with pesticides and stress form a super threat to human health. The exhaust of cars and trucks, which we all take for granted, is so powerful it crosses nature's protective barrier in the womb, the placenta, and injures our babies. The number of cars and trucks has more than doubled since the 1950s. We are producing a new damaged generation, the exhausted ones. Let's introduce Dr. Frederica Pereira from the Mailman School of Public Health, Columbia University. A small story about her study broke in the New York Times for February 16, 2005. It was an Associated Press piece titled, "Pollution is Linked to Fetal Harm." Google that title, the article pops up top of the pile. It reads, "Exposure to pollutants caused chiefly by vehicles was measured by backpack air monitors worn by the women during the third trimester of pregnancy. When the babies were born, genetic alterations were measured. Researchers found an increase of about 50% in the level of persistent genetic abnormalities among infants with high levels of exposure," said the study's senior author, Dr. Frederica P. Pereira, director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. Quote, "We already knew that air pollutants significantly reduced fetal growth, but this is the first time we've seen evidence that they can change chromosomes in utero," Dr. Pereira said, adding that the kind of genetic changes that occurred had been linked in other studies to increased risk of cancer. Well, those three paragraphs in the New York Times note that vehicle exhaust is altering the genes of newborns and a whole generation, and not in a good way. It's a shame that car pollution stories don't warrant the full-page spreads available to car makers and oil company advertisers. But Dr. Pereira said much more in a talk titled "Prenatal Exposures to Pollutants and Future Health Risks." It was part of a policymaker education course for congressional staff, organized by the Harvard Medical School Center for Health and the Global Environment. It was on March 30, 2005. You can be briefed like the Congress staff by watching the video. I'll tell you how to find the video and a better quality audio version of the speech later in this broadcast. You can find my 2006 piece, "The Polluted Womb," in my show blog at ecoshock.org. From our first moments of life to our last, air pollution can damage human health. Let's clear the air. Thank you for listening, and please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Corey Weir, Selenet.ca, and there's another site, rankandfile.ca. They're all on top of this, that we are in the age when these, you don't just get a formal letter posted in the Star and the Sun telling you what happened. Rank and file people with a lot of talent, like Corey and others, Sid Ryan, go to Sid Ryan's Facebook. If there's anybody who's, I shouldn't say he's, what's the word, Schadenfreude? Is that the word, Schadenfreude?
Well, yeah, it is.
Do I know how to say it?
You
say it.
Yeah, you said it fine. It's the concept is, though, of course.
I'm not saying. I think.
I don't think
he's doing his duty.
He's doing his duty.
He feels your pain, as Bill Clinton says.
Right.
But he also, in the back of his mind, he wants to say, I told you so.
Yeah, and he did.
I warned you. This show was coming down the road.
Yeah.
And if there's anybody who knows the pulse of Canadian labor right across the board, all of, from sea to sea to sea.
Phil, if I can say something about, I mean, there's a lot of things to say about that Unifor has done here that is just wrong. Of course, raiding raiding was absolutely forbidden in the labor movement, and it should be. But I want to say in particular that Jerry Diaz chose a moment and destroyed the moment with this story when there was so much outrage at Tim Hortons as a corporation,
yes,
for the way they treat their workers, and labor was getting so interested in it. If Unifor needs new members, let them pay some organizers to go out and organize Tim Hortons. You know, I work for a small union, and we actually represent some Tim Hortons workers. It's very tough. It's tough organizing them. It's tough keeping them with a collective agreement. And it's tough representing them because they are run on a very tyrannical basis. The franchisees they are squeezed by the corporation, and of course, like any straw boss, they squeeze the workers. Right.
Now, by the way, can you update us so you're aware of this? These demonstrations are ongoing, right?
They are. Although I noticed that they have been less in the news, but this will inevitably impact.
The effort.
But you know, there's lots of Tim Hortons out there. If unions want to organize, I mean, they should do it. You know, it's like, by all means. I mean, the Tim Hortons workers really, really need your help right now. And it's
remember, you're right. Go ahead.
To me, it is very distressing that at a moment when the whole labor movement was getting active and was having with these spontaneous demonstrations, and the press was even hammering Tim Hortons because they were so ham-handed in the way they were abusing their staff because they were angry that the provincial government raised the minimum wage after it being frozen for 10 years, right? And it's just it's terrible that it got knocked off track, you know, by this issue with people who already belonged to a union and a union with a very long, proud history, you know, and didn't need a new union. They needed to solve their internal problems. It doesn't mean they need a new union.
Well, we're starting to see pushback, thank goodness, from labor across the board. There is a number of these super bargain outfits who they have an absolute law. There will be no unions. You remember that in Walmart, went to Quebec and they built had the structure up and everything, and the workers formed a union, and Walmart left.
Yeah,
rather than accepting to have a union, they said, that's it, we're out of here. So, you know, and that's when you realize also your big friends in politics desert you, particularly if it's the Liberal Party. But, you know, up until that time, they're your friend. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. But there's a detail I want to make sure I mention involved here. In the Unite Here documentation and evidence, you can find it online. There is an issue that was adding to the problem, which was racism. There are allegations, heavy allegations, that there are racial tensions inside that local. And Sid Ryan rightly put his finger on that and said, you know, you can't, it's like hearing about sexual harassment. If that allegation is there, it behooves the international or any center, labor center, to actually move in and establish the facts and then deal with anybody who might be perpetrating it. It is not something you can just say, oh, that's how it is. No, that is not how it is. There has to be a fight over that. And Unite Here was receiving reports and complaints, a lot of them, which detailed incidents involving people being called dirty names in this battle. So when I hear that there's been a trusteeship and that one of the reasons for it was that because there were allegations of that type and evidence, people talking, saying it was who the victim was and et cetera, that I would say any union should do its duty. That's what a trusteeship is for. You can't allow a rogue local to start having its own rules, and particularly if there is an issue between the members, which it's always dangerous that there is. There's also gender issues. But people need to know that. And it's another reason why a union like Unifor should not be nosing around and championing one side or another. If there is an issue, they need to say what they think of that. If you're going to recruit them, are you recruiting on a basis of favoring one ethnic group against another ethnic group? Because that might be the accusation. CLC told them don't do it for a lot of reasons. That, to my mind, is the biggest one. We'll see how it goes. It is not going to be pretty. What's going to happen here is not going to be pretty. It's going to be a mess. And one of the reasons we talk about it on the Tater Report is that it is not reported adequately. If you were to go by the statements of Jerry Diaz in Huffington Post, you may as well forget it. You're not learning anything. He's not providing evidence. He's just making noises. When we talk to Sid Ryan, we get facts, which we prefer. And it's we think people need to know about this. And we'll, as I say, we're going to follow this. I think we'll take a break. I'm trying to remember what we have. Whatever that is, we're going to take a break and come back shortly. That was the Lord. Wonderful young woman, very brave, very smart. I follow her on Twitter because, you know, Susan Saranda is one of my leaders, and Lord. Lord has come in for some grief lately. It's one of the most fantastic cultural phenomena. She's at the age of 16, 17, she had this record. I used to call them records anyway, this recording. And it hit so big that she'd never been on a stage before, and the world knew about her. And so then they had to put her actually on the stage, and it turns out she's very authentic, very smart. And last night, she did not receive the due attention at the awards. What's the name of those awards?
The Grammys.
The Grammys.
Yeah.
And there's the media, mainstream media is saying, well, it's because it's a male chauvinist thing, you know, that, and this is a running issue about the status of women and the way they're treated in the music industry and ignored or slighted. I think everybody's trying to cover something that is about Lord that needs to be recognized and respected. She chose not to perform in Israel recently, and she's come in for some grief on that front. And I am amazed that she has that kind of courage because it's a tough world out there. And somebody chose to heckle her recently, and she handled it gracefully. And by the way, I'm so impressed that she's, you know, this is political stuff. When people are artists, you know, they usually find this a little disconcerting. And she only made it. We don't even know actually what basis she decided that she wasn't going to. But certainly there are debates amongst artists and performers and many theater people and movie people who decide not to because of this ongoing issue. Whether it's the attack status of Gaza or the settlements on the West Bank, but there's a lot of anger. And so this is being debated. But at any rate, I just thought, the mainstream media wasn't helping me out where I wish to be helped. I want them to recognize how you know, the struggles that go on in the culture, which are like sport. These struggles are really deeply political. Super Bowl, who's, you know, the issue, who's going to be celebrated, who's going to be flipped the coin? Is it going to be another Bush or is it going to be another general? I mean, these things are all highly political. And only the biggest guys make the call. And we're going to put that kid on? Are we going to delete this one? Who's going to sing? That's all big stuff. And but Lorde started off with that very nice song, which she's a poet. So the language she uses is, you know, we're not royal. Really, I think, hit a nerve with people. They like the sound of that. We're the ordinary. That's how people were reading it. But being a poet, she doesn't have to answer. She says, make of it what you think. Anyway, so this is the Tater Report. It is CIT 89.5 FM. And Phil Conlon is here. A matter that I want to make sure we say something about on the program is this Canada's decision to involve itself in the problems of Myanmar, Bangladesh, India, China, and to pretend that they've discovered the greatest humanitarian crisis and all this is very irritating. There is, in my mind, a game going on here where they're trying to set up the government of Myanmar, set it up. They have the usual players, Bono, or do what you say, Bono, I don't know, Bono. You can have him, that's all I say. Bono, Bob Ray, others want to correct or help. They don't want to do any such thing. They want to interfere in the internal affairs of Myanmar. And the line is, we have these refugees from an incident last fall which began with an attack on army posts, 30 of them, by an armed group with historical identification. It is not an insurgent group. It's an army, and it has a leadership. It's two principal backers, the United States and Saudi Arabia. So why don't we just put that on the table and discuss that so that if we're going to – but instead, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, and others all say, no, the issue is the army of Myanmar. It is not true. There are a minimum of 7-8 ethnic armies. They're called armies inside Myanmar that are not at peace with the central government. Are you aware of that, Phil?
Yes, I was. They're not.
And so you have this. And guess the New York Times has looked at this problem and decided the problem is the Myanmar government. It's not these armed groups. They don't. None of them are responsible for anything. All they get to do is fire back or do what they wish. That country is not Canada. It is not Britain. It's not France. It has its own history. It is a former colony of Britain. And because the British used to run it and extract their wealth from it and exploit its people, the British think they get to be number one in solving any upcoming problems, which is serious malarkey. If you were the colonial power, you have to go to the back of the line. You don't go to the front of the line. You have to stay in the back because if your name comes up, whoever should be in charge of any resolutions should turn to you and say, just keep quiet. You caused a lot of it. You were the colonial power. Stay out of it. But instead, the colonial thinking, and particularly in Ottawa, and the colonial thinking in the U.S. and London is, well, we used to run that place. Therefore, we have a duty to come and help. No, the answer to that is no, you don't. It's the opposite. And the Toronto Star made fun of made a point of saying Duterte of the Philippines met with Suu Kyi, the political leader of Myanmar, and he told her, never mind these NGOs. They're just a bunch of noise. I thought that was pretty good advice, actually. But you see, Toronto Star said, he's not a nice man. Well, is Trump a nice man? Is Trudeau a nice man? What is all this? The Philippines, and Phil, you know a lot about this. It's not an easy place to rule. It's a lot of people. There's a lot of things,
and a lot of U.S. Army bases.
Yes.
All over the country, U.S. Army trainers, special forces, you know. So whatever the Filipino leader says, he's got to have his shoulder.
Washington. Duterte has a tendency to talk bluntly and directly. And it is rather apparent that he's a popular leader. But his point was that he's, of course, part of this South Asian issue. And the U.S., we want to remember, we were told, is pivoting to Asia in order to contend with China, which is minding its own business. And the business part's what bothers U.S. They're very good at business. They're very good at what they do. And to the point it's almost becoming laughable about this. But Obama said he's going to pivot. What he meant was, I'm going to throw more warships into the region. I'm going to exercise more direct power. One thing has happened is there's a pushback. Vietnam now, which was looking very friendly, is not so friendly. Cambodia, not so friendly. Myanmar, which was trying to make nice and do everything and that they were asked to do, now they're starting to push back because this idea is that you don't make any decisions in your countries or your region without the U.S. telling you that's good or not good. Just to correct the record for the Trudeau and Bobre's going to take another trip out there. You remember how he helped Sri Lanka?
Oh, that was wonderful. He's always helping. He's a very helpful guy.
He helped the Kurds, by the way. Yeah, did a lot of work with the Kurds. So he'd been kind of quiet about the Kurds lately. And they've been quiet about him, so I guess it's even. But the claim is that Myanmar is not implementing and not doing anything on its internal problem. But in fact, the Rakhine State, where the crisis has been, they did something really quite unprecedented, dramatic. They asked Kofi Annan, former Secretary General of the United Nations, for whom I actually don't have any respect, but he's got a big title. And he has done a lot of footwork for the colonial powers, et cetera. But he was asked, probably with the blessing of the Washington and Paris and London, he was asked by Suu Kyi to come to Myanmar, to go to Rakhine State, and to consult and to have a body of advisors, whatever he wanted, to make a recommendation as to how to handle the problem. Now, what could be more reasonable? And he took a year, and then he wrote a report. And he gave the report to Suu Kyi and the government of Myanmar. And they said, thank you. We agree with it. And we will now work to implement it. And the day that they received that report, they got attacked at 30 of their posts by this army that is a leader of which is a Saudi. I think he's a Saudi citizen. Well, he spends a lot of time.
He's a resident. He's a resident. Yeah.
So you say, okay, and their army reacted to being attacked. Armies will tend to do that. If you attack them, they tend to get kind of excited. But in reporting, the emphasis wasn't on they've got a report and they say they're going to implement it, and they didn't even write their own Myanmar report. This happens to be Kofi Annan, who has a lot of respect around the world. And so that's what has to make you very suspicious. Why isn't Canada saying they like the Kofi Annan report? Do they like it or don't they? Because it's there. And also, Suu Kyi's government said they will implement it. What's wrong with that? I thought that would – isn't that progress? And to the extent that you can have – put your nose into the business of another country, okay, you did that. Why not congratulate Kofi Annan? Why aren't Canadians told – that Kofi Annan made the blasted report. By the way, why doesn't a star in the Globe tell us what's in it? He wasn't doing this for fun. It's a practical plan. I don't know if Bob Ray has one, but Kofi Annan has one. And you can't accuse him of bad faith because every element of that was something that had been asked for. And then they did it. So I think just to wind this up, remember that the U.S. is pivoting into the region, and number one problem on the in there, according to them, is China. And China is talking to Bangladesh. China's talking to Myanmar, and they've actually worked out a plan for the return of the refugees. By the way, remember the game, according to the Star, Globe, et cetera, was to chase people out. Well, if the plan was to chase them out, why is there a plan to return them? That doesn't make sense, does it? And how can you use all these dirty, heavy words like genocide if you say we want them to come back? And, well, I'll leave that to Bob and the other wise guys to see if they can figure it out. But listen, Kofi Annan wrote a report. I tell everybody, this is a Taylor report. Read his report. Show a little respect for the government of Myanmar. And since you haven't ever been there, don't think you know a lot about it. So I want to thank Braden. Done great work. This is under trying condition. We always create trying conditions here just to test everybody out. So we really appreciate it. And Phil Conlon. And we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lindsay Kashgarian, Program Director of the National Priorities Project, who assesses the two-year federal budget deal recently passed by Congress, and how the allocation of these funds impacts vital non-military government programs. Dima Khalidi, founder and director of Palestine Legal, who discusses the importance of a federal judge's ruling that blocked enforcement of a Kansas law that punishes people who boycott Israel. And the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, who talks about the campaign's goals and planned actions to challenge the evils of systemic racism, poverty, and the nation's distorted morality. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Associated Press reports five mass graves in Myanmar have been identified by Rohingya Muslim refugees who fled to Bangladesh. The mass graves are located in the village of Gudarpin, where army soldiers last summer shot and killed Rohingya teenagers. The Myanmar government has denied any knowledge of the mass graves, but did report that a grave existed in another town where terrorists had been killed. The AP reports that Myanmar's army has engaged in the systematic slaughter of Muslim minority Rohingya civilians with support from Buddhist villagers. Relatives say nearly 400 people were killed during the attack in late August. The violence is another example of what appears to be the genocidal mass murder of the minority Rohingya in Myanmar's embattled Rakhine state. Survivors say Myanmar soldiers had come prepared to commit atrocities. Along with standard military equipment, soldiers carried shovels to dig pits and acid to burn the faces of those killed so victims could not be identified. Yang He Lee, the UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in Myanmar, said that recent reports of attacks against minority Rohingya civilians, including mass murder, arbitrary arrests, torture, and enforced disappearances, are acts that have been alleged against the military and security forces for generations. She reports that other ethnic groups, including the Kachin, Karen, Kareni, and Shan, have all suffered similar horrific human rights violations at the hands of Myanmar's armed forces over several decades. In a new draft report, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security called on law enforcement agencies to continuously vet Sunni Muslim immigrants entering the U.S. who are deemed to have at-risk demographic profiles. The draft report, obtained by Foreign Policy magazine, looked at 25 U.S.-based terrorist incidents from 2001 to 2017, concluding there would be great value for the United States government in dedicating resources to continuously evaluate persons of interest and suggesting that immigrants to the U.S. be tracked on a long-term basis. If the draft report is fully implemented, it would represent a vast expansion of the Trump administration's policies targeting many Muslim immigrants, extending vetting from those attempting to enter the United States to those already legally in the country, including permanent residents. The report came to light a month after another controversial report by Homeland Security and the Justice Department was released, which claims that 3 of every 4 individuals convicted of international terrorism or terrorism-related offenses were immigrants. Critics claim the study had serious methodological flaws because it cherry-picked the data to justify the Trump administration's restrictive immigration policies. A Homeland Security official who reviewed the draft report concluded it would push policymakers toward unfair and discriminatory surveillance of specific ethnic groups. Other observers fear that the report could lead Homeland Security to ignore other homegrown national security threats from far-right extremists and violent white supremacists. School children in urban communities are at risk from exposure to air toxins causing illnesses linked to multiple brain-related disorders. The study, which found that Black, Latino, and low-income students were the most likely to be exposed to harmful toxins, was based on research examining environmental conditions at 90,000 public schools across America. A team of researchers led by Sarah Grineski of the University of Utah analyzed health risks at schools exposed to a dozen neurotoxins, including lead, mercury, and cyanide. The 5 most polluted school communities included New York City, Chicago, Jersey City, and Camden, New Jersey. Many cash-strapped school districts build public schools on the most inexpensive land available, often located near busy roads, factories, and contaminated brownfield pollution sites. The study used data from the Federal Census and the Environmental Protection Agency, which found that pre-kindergarten students are often at more risk for air pollution than teenagers. According to the Guardian newspaper, more than a quarter of all Black students attend schools with the worst air pollution. In contrast, the majority of white students, who make up over half of the students in the study, attend schools with much lower rates of toxic pollution exposure. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Despite Republican Party control of the U.S. Senate, the House of Representatives, and the White House, a divided GOP needed the votes of minority Democrats to pass a 2-year budget agreement. Although many Democrats had wanted to use their leverage to pass legislation to prevent the deportation of more than 700,000 DACA recipients, undocumented children who were brought to the U.S. by their parents, after a 5.5-hour government shutdown, enough Democrats voted for the bill, and President Trump signed the budget into law on February 9th. The approved budget spends $500 billion more than current law allows by suspending a 2011 law pushed by Freedom Caucus conservatives that set hard caps on discretionary spending and included an automatic trigger known as sequester cuts if Congress attempted to bypass those spending caps. The budget deal for 2018 spends $700 billion for the military and $591 billion for non-military programs. Overall, 54% of the federal discretionary budget is now spent on the military and nuclear weapons. President Trump's recently announced 2019 budget, which is not likely to be passed by Congress, calls for a 14.1% increase in military spending, while making deep cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, education, food stamps, transportation, and other essential government services. Your reporter spoke with Lindsay Kashgarian, program director of the National Priorities Project, who assesses the 2-year federal budget deal passed by Congress and how the allocation of these federal funds impacts vital non-military programs.
The budget that Congress passed last week
was the budget for fiscal year 2018, which actually started on October 1st of last year. So it took them several months to get the job done. And a lot of the national attention about why the budget was such a difficult process in Congress and what the disagreements were focused on the need for a humanitarian solution for the Dreamers, you know, these people who were brought to the United States as immigrants, as young children, and have since made their lives here. But what didn't get quite as much attention was the differences between spending in the budget for the Pentagon, military, and nuclear weapons versus spending for everything else that's funded by the discretionary budget. And that's the part of the budget. It's over $1 trillion. And that's what Congress decides each year when they go through this budget process. And essentially, the question was how much they would fund the Pentagon and military versus how much they would fund everything else. Now, Democrats generally were trying to negotiate for more spending for things like education and health and the State Department, while they were also willing to accept higher spending on the Pentagon. Many Republicans wanted higher spending on the Pentagon without raising spending on those domestic things, although some of them wanted to cut both. And the deal they came to was to raise spending a little bit for each. So they gave $80 billion above what were the previous spending limits to the Pentagon. And they gave $60 billion above the previous limits to everything else. And in Washington, D.C. politics, this is what people refer to as parity of spending between the Pentagon and between everything else. But of course, $80 billion doesn't equal $60 billion, so they're not equal in that sense. And it's also as if you took half of your inheritance and gave it to one child and then took the other half and gave it to your four other children and called it equal. So there are a couple of reasons why parity is really a bad name for this.
Now, Lindsay, in terms of the distribution of tax dollars towards military and non-military spending, what does it say about the nation's priorities at the moment in terms of the dollars going to fund new weapons systems, other projects that Pentagon has in mind, new fighter jets and all the rest, versus what really needs to be addressed in the country in terms of social programs, especially considering the growing gap between the rich and poor in this country?
Well, in almost any given year, more than half of our discretionary budget, that pot that Congress decided last week, goes to the Pentagon and military. And they maintained that ratio in this budget deal. 54% of the funds they allocated will go to the Pentagon and nuclear weapons, while the remaining 46% will go to everything else. So clearly, the priority that Congress places is that a military solutions trump, pardon the expression, everything else. The budget the president released, which was his budget request for 2019, and does come into direct conflict with the budget limits that Congress set for 2019. So it's unlikely that this budget proposal will become a reality, but that's always the case with presidential budget requests. But the budget request we saw shows clearly what the president's priorities are and where he wants to see our government headed. And what we saw there was that he maintained Pentagon spending of over $700 billion a year, which is about a 10% increase over recent spending levels that we've had for the Pentagon. And it's also a spending level that keeps us in the range of spending more than the next 8 to 10 countries in the world combined. We spend more than 3 times as much as China. We spend 9 times as much as Russia on our military. So our military spending is already sky high, and now it's growing.
What kind of policies do the minority Democrats, who certainly don't have much control in the House or the Senate right now, what do they bring to the table in terms of their views on the levels of military spending that should be approved?
It's a wild mix. Last week, when the budget deal was passing Congress, you had Senator Chuck Schumer, who is the Senate leader of the Democrats, saying that he supported both more military spending and spending for the middle class. So you have everything from that to Democrats like Pramila Jayapal or Adam Smith in the House of Representatives who question our military spending and really recognize that there is such a thing as too much. And one of the things that I think that people who across the political spectrum, again, this is not limited to Democrats, you know, there are definitely fiscal hawk Republicans who are very interested in seeing us call back some of the wasteful Pentagon spending that's out there. We need to make it more understood that more Pentagon spending does not equal more safety.
That was Lindsay Kashgarian, Program Director of the National Priorities Project. Find links to more analysis of military and non-military spending in the U.S. federal budget by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A federal judge in Kansas recently ruled that a state law making it illegal to support the Palestinian Civil Society call for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, against Israel for its illegal occupation of the West Bank was unconstitutional. Kansas is one of 24 states with anti-BDS laws on the books. The state laws take various forms, including prohibiting individuals who support BDS from being awarded state contracts and/or prohibiting states from investing in companies that boycott Israel. The BDS movement calls for dismantling the wall that cuts through Palestinian land, guaranteeing the right of Palestinians to return to their homes inside Israel, and assuring that equal rights are accorded to all Palestinian citizens of Israel. Federal legislation known as the Israel Anti-Boycott Act has been introduced in Congress with bipartisan support and is a top legislative priority this year for AIPAC, the most powerful and most well-funded pro-Israel lobbying group in the U.S. The proposed bill includes harsh criminal sanctions for U.S. persons who comply with or support boycotts of Israel in response to calls by the United Nations, the European Union, or other international governmental organizations. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dima Khalidi, founder and director of Palestine Legal. The group, based in Chicago and founded in 2012, works to protect the constitutional rights of those advocating for Palestinian freedom. Here, Khalidi explains the federal judge's ruling, upholding a U.S. citizen's right to engage in protest and boycotts targeting Israel's illegal occupation, and its significance.
The ACLU brought the lawsuit on behalf of a Mennonite school teacher who was involved in a teacher training program and had to contract with the state to be paid by the state for training other teachers. And because of Kansas's their new anti-boycott law, which prohibits individuals, contractors with the state from boycotting Israel, she was required to sign a certification that she didn't boycott Israel in order to be involved with this teacher training program. And because her church and she herself decided to boycott certain Israeli companies and other companies that are complicit in Israel's occupation, she refused to sign the certification. And she is not able to be involved in this teacher training program as a result. So it's clear in this case that there's a political litmus test being applied for those that want to contract with the state. And that is completely constitutionally unacceptable. The math teacher tried to get a preliminary injunction to stop the state from enforcing this law while the litigation proceeds. And the judge granted that preliminary injunction. So the state is now blocked from enforcing this law as long as this lawsuit is ongoing. So the decision was really important in making very clear that this law appears unconstitutional as a violation of First Amendment rights. The judge confirmed that boycotts for Palestinian rights are the same as the boycotts that precipitated the Supreme Court case, NAACP v. Claiborne, in 1982. And those were boycotts against white businesses in the South protesting segregation and racism during the civil rights era. This decision is a really important precedent for other challenges that will surely come up against other anti-boycott laws and to prevent other anti-boycott laws from being enacted, hopefully, when legislators see that a judge has ruled this way. The ACLU has also brought a lawsuit against a very similar law in Arizona, and that ruling is pending as well.
Dima Khalidi, Israel itself has just created a blacklist of 20 international organizations, including Code Pink and Jewish Voice for Peace, that can no longer enter Israel and therefore can't get into the West Bank due to their support for BDS. What impact do you think this will have on efforts to squelch support for BDS?
Yes, this is clearly one of the many strategies that Israel is using to intimidate, to bully people who are speaking out for Palestinian rights. And they're trying to send a message that if you take this kind of position, not only will you not be allowed into this country, whatever your background is, but you will also be pursued in other ways. And as I said, Palestine Legal, my organization, has been documenting for 5 years the array of ways that Israel and Israel advocacy groups in the U.S. are targeting activists and regular people who are speaking out publicly for Palestinian rights. And the ways range from lawsuits to this legislative strategy to defamation campaigns against individuals. They're very targeted against individual students, professors, other activists, profiles of people on the internet, on anonymous websites that claim they are pro-terrorist or anti-Semitic for their views. We're seeing universities being pressured very hard by Israel advocacy groups to punish student activists who are protesting, who are bringing divestment resolutions. The list goes on. And all of these methods of suppression are aimed at silencing people who believe in Palestinian human rights, who want to see accountability for Israel's decades of subjugation of Palestinians, dispossession of Palestinians.
That was Dima Khalidi, founder and director of Palestine Legal. Learn more about Palestine Legal and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Religious leaders, joined by members of civil rights groups, labor unions, and fast food workers, gathered in Washington, D.C., and more than two dozen states across the U.S. on February 5th to launch the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. The campaign, co-chaired by Moral Monday's founder, Reverend William Barber, and Reverend Liz Theo Harris, say their mission is to continue the work of the original Poor People's Campaign, organized by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the late 1960s. The coalition of groups engaged in the campaign kicked off 40 days of what they described as moral action to highlight the human impact of policies which promote systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, and environmental devastation. On February 12th, the Poor People's Campaign joined fast food and other low-paid workers in Los Angeles, Detroit, Memphis, in other cities across the U.S., to rally support for a $15 per hour minimum wage and the right to unionize. In Memphis, hundreds of Fight for 15 activists commemorated the 50th anniversary of the city's 1968 sanitation workers' strike, supported by Reverend King and the civil rights movement at the time. Your reporter spoke with Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-director of the Cairo Center, who, as Poor People's Campaign co-chair, was in Memphis to lead the protests. Here, Reverend Theo Harris talks about the campaign's goals and planned actions to challenge the evils of racism, poverty, and the nation's distorted morality.
So for many years, grassroots organizations across the United States have been saying that we need to kind of come together and build a Poor People's Campaign for today. We do draw lessons on theory and theology from Dr. King and from the Poor People's Campaign of 1967 and 68. You know, in that campaign, the last campaign of Dr. King's life, he was connecting the kind of what he called the evils, the tripartite evils of systemic racism, of militarism, and of economic exploitation, and said that poor and dispossessed people of all races and all geographies needed to be brought together into a united and organized force in order to kind of wake up the nation and unsettle a bunch of what was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see today, 50 years later, there's a 60% increase in poverty since there was in 1968. The military budget is even more of a huge section of our budget than it was, you know, 50 years ago. And systemic racism is still alive and well. And so we're kind of building a new Poor People's Campaign, reigniting the campaign that Dr. King and others were leading 50 years ago, and saying that it's time for a kind of deep moral revival in our nation. We need to, you know, shake things up, and we need a breakthrough to be able to prioritize what's really needed in, on the key issues of our day, and see that, that the real moral issues of our time are things like health care and living wages and education for our kids and voting rights and an end to the kind of pollution and ecological devastation that are taking place. And so poor people and clergy and activists and others are coming together and calling for this campaign and pledging to be a part of 40 days of moral direct action and nonviolent civil disobedience in this coming spring.
And Reverend Theo Harris, could you lay out some of the goals that you're working on within the Poor People's Campaign? What are some of the policy demands that you'd like to communicate to Congress and the White House?
Yeah, so we are calling for 40 days of moral direct action, focused on a moral agenda that is still in the works. Right now, the goals of the campaign are really twofold. One is to shift the moral narrative that is happening and out there in our nation right now. You know, when we looked at the 2016 presidential election, there were 26 presidential debates in the primary and in the general election. And in those 26 debates, not one of them focused on problems of living wages or universal health care, of poverty and voting rights, of ecological devastation and the problems of the war economy. And so to be able to have gotten through such an expensive and such a interesting 2016 presidential debates and not have the issues that are affecting the majority of people in this country the majority of the time means that we need to do something to kind of shift the narrative and make it impossible that our elected officials and candidates can talk about what they're going to do and not actually speak to poverty and racism and the issues that are plaguing our nation today. And
Reverend Theo Harris, can you tell us a bit about some of the dates coming up for actions that the Poor People's Campaign has planned around the country?
Great. So from March 1st through 5th, many of folks with the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, will be in Selma, Alabama. It's the 53rd anniversary of Bloody Sunday, and we'll be there making the connection between poverty and economic injustice and voting rights. Around April 4th, which is the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, will be in Memphis again with the National Civil Rights Museum and with others that are looking to the legacy of Dr. King 50 years after his assassination. Then on June 23rd, we'll be doing a mass mobilization in Washington, D.C., where we're talking about the next steps in the campaign and what people are called to do to continue to build power and organization amongst those that are impacted by the injustices that are in our world today. And so this spring, we're hoping that folks all across the country in state houses will take place in these 40 days, this 6 weeks of organizing and education and moral direct action.
That was Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-director of the Cairo Center and co-chair, along with Reverend William Barber, of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WTND in Macomb, Georgia, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Why white supremacy means white male supremacy. When Donald Trump lamented at the loss of one of his employees' career, a bomb of female protest erupted. For he, not surprisingly, ignored the suffering of his employees' ex-wives. The only real surprise here was why the surprise. After the Roy Moore debacle of a U.S. Senate candidate's Lolita complex, as in a hankering for young girls, who can dare plead surprise? Only someone who hasn't really been looking can feign surprise. Trump's central program is to somehow return America to the 1950s when Negroes were quiet, women were submissive, and Hispanics knew their place, like Mexico, Puerto Rico. This fever dream of Back to the Future reality show is the focus of Trump World. To do this, you have to ignore history to build a new history, an imitation of the supposed old days. Yes, it's crazy, but it ain't the only time the U.S. went crazy. Consider the war mania that resulted from 9/11. War on anybody to quell the beating heart drunk with fear. Iraq, check. Afghanistan, double check. War to salve the worried American soul. In Trump world, blacks don't count. Hispanics don't count. Arabs don't count. Women don't count either. Yes, even white women. It's time for the good old boys. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Respect our elders, and if led down the path completely, we learn to hold our elders and ancestors to the highest degree and esteem. Growing up, I heard hundreds of stories while sitting in a rocking chair. Some would have thought that I was spending quality time with one of my elders. Truth be told, I was a child plotting on the cookie jar. Still, lessons were learned. My sense of family, understanding of struggle, and thirst for knowledge were all born in that chair. To be in the presence of one born in 1889 was unfathomable, yet there she was. To look at a beautiful, strong, sensitive person who'd worked fields, overcome blindness and slurs, and didn't rest on the power of her nearly Caucasian skin complexion, and know that I was of her blood filled me with fortitude and sent me off to investigate life. Did I always follow my first instinct or completely listen to heeded warnings? Absolutely not. But at least I was blessed to have received them. Now, a quarter of a century after she's passed on to protect me from above, I was faced with a silly scenario, and this piece is about honoring the ancestor that started the family I belong to. On Christmas, on a visit, my father said he didn't want one of the photos because I looked just like my great-grandmother, and it was too much of a reminder. If I didn't know better, I would have taken offense. Since I did, and I do, I chuckled and was tickled to know by his comment that I had elevated. My rise has been hard fought and won with honesty, bluntness, and control. I'm that replica of a woman who lost much, yet had and still has an abundance. I'm a copy of She Who Tells Like It Is, makes the point known, and does my part to reach back to one needing motivation. I cannot run from the past, nor do I want to. Instead, I live the best today possible, fussy, feeling my underused potential weighing me down, yet getting in motion every day to work, educate others, share the strength of my learning through this experience of poor choices of friends, mates, places I frequented, and the flash my lifestyle held. I watch C-SPAN, the History Channel, and Nat Geo, and test my knowledge in the present and in reverse, and it keeps me open to and ready for change. That change is a journey in progress that will best be realized outside these gates, but has long since been embarked upon in reality, recognizing shortcomings, wrongs, and pain to go from hurting to healing to helping and leading. That's honor of my ancestry.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Decisions by the band Outer National. Now, we're going to be talking a lot about decisions today. We're going to be talking specifically about what people need to do in the face of unspeakable horrors going on in the world today. People need to make big decisions because what we do and what we think today is really going to matter, possibly for the future of all of humanity. At the back end of the show, we'll hear two pieces from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and somebody that I've been playing a lot lately. The first is on the terror of deportations, millions of families split apart, and it's from a DVD of a speech that Avakian gave back in 2012, and it's called BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. The next is from another DVD of a speech that Avakian made more recently, and this is called The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. Now, this is a response to a question posed by somebody in the audience about immigrants fighting against everything that is going on against them. The question was, how can we protect those who need to be on the streets fighting with us? How can we protect the ones that are being targeted directly? How can we get them to be on the streets? This is a crucial question at a time of the Trump-Pence ethnic cleansing attacks on immigrants and immigration and the courageous resistance of Dreamers and many others. So that'll be the last part of the show. And I'm going to begin the show today by replaying an interview that I did a number of years ago with the author Ursula Le Guin. Ursula died very recently. Actually, it was on January 22nd. Ursula K. Le Guin was the author of tons of books, including The Left Hand of Darkness and Dispossessed. She is the author of 6 volumes of poetry, 20 novels, over 100 short stories, 4 volumes of essays, 11 books for children, 4 volumes of translations. You know, her work has transformed the genre of science fiction and fantasy, and her writing was influential and precious to generations of readers and writers. I had the opportunity to speak to her following the publication of her book Voices, which speaks to the importance of critical thinking and the dangers of a society that loses that. And it's set in a world where a sort of priestly class has taken over and reading has become illegal, punishable by death. Much of what she says is even more relevant today under the anti-science, anti-thought Trump-Pence fascist regime. During the interview, we also touch on her other writings, the reactions of her readers, and much more. So here's the interview with Ursula Le Guin.
I really want to welcome my next guest. This is an author that I've been a fan of since, too far back for me to reveal, but since I first read Left Hand of Darkness, went on to Dispossessed, and have read many, many other books. It's Ursula K. Le Guin. It's just amazing when you look at the work that she's done. 6 volumes of poetry, 20 novels, over 100 short stories, 4 collections of essays, 11 books for children, 4 volumes of translation. And she has a new novel out now called Voices, which is a tale set in a time and place of extreme oppression, when reading and writing are considered acts punishable by death. Ursula, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you again for the decades of imagination and wonder and awe and thought.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. I generally don't like to pigeonhole things. And I know that in particular, after having read your work as much as I have, I know that you don't like linear connections and sort of straight line cause and effect. But I really have to ask you, just looking at what is going on today in the world, how much of an influence did that have on your writing of Voices?
Well, you know, undoubtedly, a lot, but I don't know how. It's not that I don't like cause and effect and linear connections. I mean, they certainly exist, and I mean, there's science, and I really like science. But a big question like that, where everything is so complicated, why I chose to write this story at this time, I can never tell you. Maybe 20 years later or something I could, you know.
Maybe what I should start off with more is asking you to tell our listeners what this story is about.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, I hate paraphrasing. Well, it's about a kid in a city which was an old commercial, tranquil place that sort of lived off trade and was not warlike, nor was it very threatened. It had become a protectorate of a more warlike state to the south. All of a sudden, it is invaded and taken over by some people sort of out of the desert who are of a completely different culture entirely, for for one thing, they're monotheists, and the city people have lots and lots of little gods, and warlike as opposed to peaceful, and so on. And this child is actually a child of a rape during the invasion. She's what's called a siege brat. So she grows up in a conquered city in a kind of half-destroyed culture. Essentially, her people have been enslaved, but she lives in a house where books are kept, and books are now illegal, and with an older relative who can kind of tell her what things were like and give her books to read. So, well, she's all cut out to be a perfect little revolutionary or rebel. She has the information of what things ought to be like, and yet her world is a kind of a destroyed one. So that's the position mm-hmm. that you sort of start with.
Yeah. Now, the reason I was asking, and I agree with you, I think I would go back to that point about linear cause and effect, because I do agree that I also like science a lot, and I think that there is cause and effect in the world. But it's nothing is ever so simple as one thing directly leads to another, and in terms of without there being many other factors coming into play.
Not in human psychology, anyway.
Right. Or in humans,
a test tube, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's something that really struck me in this, in terms of the relationship between what we have today and what you've sort of created, and the tale you're telling about what's going on in this world, and the fact that even something as well, for instance, words. One of the things that happens in this conquered society is that the people, the oppressors, the conquerors come in and they view things like literature and words as actual demonic forces.
Written words.
Yeah.
They're an oral culture.
Right.
And so writing is demonic, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And should be destroyed. And those who insist upon reading and writing are destroyed.
And the other part of it that comes in is there's a certain fundamentalism. When you said that they were monotheistic, it's also there's a certain fundamentalism that actually doesn't seem to place much value on, or even looks at it as bad, is the idea of critical thinking being essential to human life.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that monotheism and fundamentalism tend to go hand in hand. Fundamentalism is a monotheistic creation. Now, it has spread and infected even Hinduism by now, but it certainly started with having a book and a word that is right and nothing else, you know, the kind of very cutting the truth down to one single truth.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, when I was reading this and I looked at the idea that you know that the existing literature in this village, in this area, the existing literature was and had to be, you know, spirited away and hidden and protected. The idea that the written word, you couldn't even admit to having read a book or knowing how to read. And I kept thinking of that in relation to the kind of know-nothingism that's generated a lot today, you know, frankly.
Oh, yeah. Well, also, you ask any intellectual American kid who went through a normal American high school if Americans love bookworms. you know what I'm talking about.
Right, yeah.
It can be hell to be 15 years old and be a bookworm.
Mm-hmm.
Because people, they don't understand, they don't want to understand, and they disapprove. So little mild form of hatred of the book is kind of endemic in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now you attach, and this is clear in you know, I think in a lot of what you write, and including in the prequel to this book, to Voices, The Gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea that storytelling and that literature and whether it's oral or written is actually extremely important to humanity or to people, because, you know, it's not just a question of humanity, but it's the cultures that you've created. This kind of thing, this kind of telling of stories is extremely important, and it's extremely important to you. Let's talk about why.
Well, I've come to think, that's a fairly common thought these days, actually, that, in fact, if we're not able to tell stories to each other, if we can't tell each other stories within our society, we're really sick. Things are really falling apart when we lose our stories. Storytelling is you know, we tend to think of the great author writing the great book and stuff, but actually what we're talking about is a society telling its stories. It's a kind of communal act. And the great writer is a great writer because people read him. They want that book, you know. And it seems to be one way that human communities weave themselves together a really, really important way is by telling their story over and over in different ways. This is who we are. And I think it also, it works for the individual. I think a lot of kids get onto books because they realize that through books they can figure out who I am. You know, the story is going to tell them to figure out what their story is going to be. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, in particular, I hate having to keep coming back to now, but I think there's actually, you know, and this is what I was saying, as much as I was trying to tell you, I don't want to be linear about this, but there's this, you can't help seeing the parallel, I think. Anybody who's at all, you know, has their eyes open at all in the world today, when you see whether it's the fundamentalism here, the Christian fundamentalism here, the Islamic fundamentalism in, you know, in other parts of the world, whatever it is, and including the fact that, you know, the danger of theocracy, the actual encroachment of theocracy in many parts of the world, including right here in this country, and what that means when you have that kind of, you know, that direction to things, and going up against that is actually the idea that people can think, that these stories, that this literature, that people can actually think about what's going on, and that can help shape their ability to analyze and dissect the world.
Right, but what feeds into the fundamentalisms and the theocracies, and this is something that I could not handle in this book, which is a fantasy, of course, is our commercial corporate structure, which allows the stories that Hollywood and TV tells are mostly worthless. They are not useful stories. They do not actually build real community. They aren't very helpful to most of them. The stuff is so stupid and so low level that it's kind of falling down on the job, it seems to me. Our visual media is how we tell a lot of our stories, but so much of it is so just commercially driven that it isn't really telling any story except what it wants to sell. This is something that I couldn't do in the book at all. This is not the kind of thing I'm any good at writing about.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you are really good at writing about, which is this question you mentioned, writing fantasy in this particular book. But you know, there's a point that someone made. I was reading some stuff on some, I guess, reviews or some interviews with you earlier that they made the point that you're often miscast as escapist. The fantasy is often miscast as escapist. Yeah. But for you, it's a whole different story. It's not escapist at all. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Cheap, lousy fantasy is escapist, and there's not much harm in it. I mean, everybody needs to escape sometimes. But serious fantasy, it's like all other serious literature. It just provides metaphors to talk about the way things actually are. And sometimes to some people, the metaphors of fantasy or science fiction seem kind of far-fetched, and they don't see why a writer needs to use that kind of symbols. But the fact is we do. It's very hard to discuss things directly. And all our literature is symbolic in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And fantasy is just kind of one type. And it seems to be the type that I am particularly good at.
Mm-hmm. And I'm talking today with Ursula K. Le Guin, the author of many, many, many books, essays, poems, all kinds of things, but most recently the author of the novel Voices, the fantasy novel Voices, which has been published by Harcourt, and it's part of a series that's actually going on. The first one was The Gifts, and I think you have a sequel to this you're planning too, right?
I read The Galleys on the third one, which is Powers, mm-hmm. and which has to do to a large extent with slavery.
Ah, well, we're going to explore. We're going to have you back to explore that one too. Because, this is exactly where, you know, interesting. This is exactly where I wanted to go on this, because one of the things when I was talking about this not being escapist, one of the things that you really do very, very well is you have taken the exploration of not only how we live, but how we could live. You know, and that's what you've posited in a lot of your work is sort of.
Well, that's kind of the beauty of science fiction and fantasy is they offer alternatives. And that is, I think, one reason why young people tend to fall for them when they discover them. Because young people are always looking for, you know, life can't really be this way. There's got to be some other way to do it. They just naturally offer alternative ways of being or thinking.
Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about epistemology, too, because...
what is it?
Not yet. We won't get to that. You can throw that in if you want. But, I mean, the basic point in relation to voices, you know, you made a statement earlier that it was something, and I'll paraphrase this time, that something along the lines of that, you know, one thing you can count on is that nothing is ever neat. And, you know, that's true in a lot of your work, and it's especially true in voices where so many things are open-ended. So many things are left open to interpretation. So many things come into play. And that when you walk out of there at the end of the novel, that you're left with thinking about what could be choices, what could be, what isn't, what might have been, and not sort of, okay, we have this path set out before us.
Right. Right. Well, that's good. That's good. That's the way I wanted it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that you also said, though, that, you know, and I think that actually part of what you've done is you've, you know, let's talk about why you wanted that, because it, you know, why do you attach so much importance to the idea that people should be invited to think? And that's actually what happens with even in the novel itself, in Voices, where the young woman is actually, you know, one of the things I think she finds so frustrating is it seems like she's often looking for clear cut answers, but the things are like a lot more fluid, a lot more liquid, and
yes,
she has to actually learn to think. Why is that important?
The kid's only 17, and she wants, you know, she wants the revolution, don't we all?
Mm-hmm.
But if they had the revolution, they'd be creamed. She has to realize that. You know, talk about contemporary relevance. Kind of, some people want, they think shock and awe is going to do it, and other people say we could try diplomacy.
Let's throw this around a little bit. As a revolutionary myself, I tended to initially like, okay, let's go with the young woman, let's go with her, and you know, and I kept. Go ahead.
Actually, you know, I had some trouble with I think my editor sort of, she kept waiting for the revolution. And you know, and she realizes that that's what a kid reading the book is going to be waiting for the revolution, and it's not going to happen.
But something does happen there.
It's going to be a big letdown. That's it. What I hope to do is supply something that's actually, it is a revolution, only it's not simple violence.
Yeah, I mean, there's a point about, you know, the resolution of things in the book, as much as there is a resolution, the resolution of things. Actually, there's a combination of things that occur. And I think actually the uprising of the people is actually something that, you know, is indispensable to how the thing actually eventually.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. If the citizens didn't turn out in the streets, nothing would ever change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk a little bit. Let's back on this epistemological approach, because I do want to probe this a little bit more. Because
what is epistemology? It's one of those words that I can spell. I don't know what it means.
We're in big trouble then.
All right, you don't have to define it. Forget.
No, no, no. It's how you actually come to know things. How you actually come to know the truth.
Well, how you come to know.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. How you come to know the truth.
Okay.
And that's why I was actually looking at this. This approach that you have about nothing is ever neat, and that you invite people to think and to discover and to go through that process and to actually interpret and analyze. And you know, I've been reading a lot, like in particular, Bob Avakian, who's one of the leading Marxist theoreticians in the world today. And he's, you know, he's actually been talking a lot about epistemology and the importance of the clash of ideas in actually uncovering the truth. And I wanted to know how much you view, you know, how you view that. How do you view the importance of the clashing of ideas, the contesting of ideas in relation to uncovering the truth?
Oh, off the top of my head, it's essential. I mean, that's what you go to college for, is to test received ideas against other received ideas and find out that there is more than one way to think and lose your bearings, you know, and do thesis and antithesis and hope to come out with a synthesis. Learning... One whole level of learning just seems to consist of questioning the received idea.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I was going to say too, is that, you know, I know you've said before too that you don't, you're sometimes you're often tempted to, and I think you were, you know, just generally in terms of your view of things, that you're tempted to, I don't know, you know, there's always a tempt to moralize. There's always a temptation to moralize. There's always a tempt to try and preach
a
lesson.
Get up on the soapbox, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but you also, you know, this point about there's that temptation, but then you have actually, you know, you've actually made a, you've made a comment about that won't work for you or for discovering the truth. And yet at the same time, you, and even in, like in this book, like you were saying, there's sort of a balance that you've tried to approach. But you, the one thing I like about your work is that you always have that balance, but there's always something that undermines it. And the point is, I think, in to me anyway, in the final analysis, balance isn't the answer. You're actually, you would never allow balance to supersede truth. And you do speak it to things from the viewpoint of the underdog, of the oppressed, in most of your books.
Yeah, I do. Comes of partly being a woman. But, you know, balance to a lot of people means stasis, that you arrive at a balance and then you stay there. To me, balance is what you do when you walk. You balance on your left foot, and then you balance on your right, and that's how you keep going. You've got to be in balance in order to walk. But the whole thing is a balancing act. Any kind of forward progress or backwards requires being in balance. And to me, what real stasis, what real really being stuck, is when things are so out of balance that they fall down and don't move. Which is kind of where the city is at when this book opens.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were talking about writing from the point of view of the oppressed and saying that, you know, and I think that actually has been from the very beginning, you've actually been one of the people who pioneered the bringing into science fiction, into fantasy, people who don't normally populate the science fiction and fantasy.
They didn't used to.
Mm-hmm.
There are more of them these days. You mean the under people.
Right. We're talking today with Ursula K. Le Guin. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. For people who are just tuning in now, I'm speaking with Ursula K. Le Guin about her new book, Voices, and her work in general and some of the thinking behind that and what's going on in the world today and what's going on in the world that Ursula creates and many of the worlds that Ursula creates, because she's one of the few people in the universe that's actually created about 20 worlds. Well, let's talk about that. You said that they used to, you know, this bringing of people who aren't, you know, who weren't part of the population of the particular genre that you work in.
Well, it used to be kind of the heroes, the guys with the spaceships, and the masses, who, you know, kind of like in Godzilla or something, that most people run screaming mm-hmm. in old-fashioned science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually incredibly elitist and incredibly male-centered. There weren't any women that counted for anything, and I'm talking way back now. That's when I kind of came crawling into the field from left wing back in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is still a lot of science fiction that is kind of written that way, that the, you know, the computer geek is going to save the world, and all the rest of us poor nerds. But the nerds have there are more nerds in science fiction and fantasy than there used to be. In fantasy, they're not all kings and princesses anymore. There are actual peasants.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things. One of the beautiful things about your work is you actually manage to make the most profound points by the portrayal of people in no matter what world they're in who are basic, struggling to get through the world. People.
Yeah. trying to keep alive. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they are in fact the ones who bring on the most fundamental and profound changes, which I find really, really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of which, now in terms of changes, again, you've also this point about bringing women in, which was a big, big point. I remember one of the things. I mean, I remember just trying to get my head wrapped around the gender bending that you did in Left Hand of Darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was just incredible. It was, in terms of, you know, you want to talk about provoking critical thought and a whole new way of looking at the world. I mean, you know, and I'll paraphrase it because you don't like to paraphrase, but the idea that you had these beings who in terms of their interpersonal relations, that at varying times, either one could be what would be the equivalent of the female partner or the male partner. They could change, and either one could get pregnant based on various changes. And it's just the whole idea of gender took on – you didn't have gender, basically.
Right. I deconstructed gender, as they would say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
I would have loved to have been in the house with you at that time. Let's get your husband on the phone.
I have a bunch of little kids running around.
There you go. There you go. You know, the other thing that you've brought in, the other thing that you brought into science fiction and fantasy is oppressed nationalities, ethnicity, race, you know, and that was a big, anybody who reads your work notices that it's not that there are no white people, but they certainly don't occupy the position that they occupy in mainstream.
It tends to be marginal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my few really conscious political decisions, particularly both in fantasy and in science fiction, was simply to put people of color at the center. And like in A Wizard of Earthsea, which is my first major fantasy, you don't find out that the hero with whom hopefully you have identified by now is kind of a copper brown guy until way into the book. I was hoping literally to trap American white adolescents into getting into a different skin.
Hmm.
And then, you know, being comfortable there and then finding out, oh, hey, he's not a white man, you know.
Uh-huh.
Some of the most moving letters I've had, they've all been fairly recent. They're from adolescents of color, both in England and in America, who said they could never read any fantasy or science fiction until they found my stuff because they weren't in it.
Hmm.
And they were in my books. I thought, all right, it paid off. That's all I was after, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
was to include people who had been just completely thoughtlessly, without any agenda, but excluded totally. Fantasy was a completely white field, except for one great book, which is Kipling's Jungle Book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the only brown hero of a major fantasy that I can think of before, I don't know, the 60s, 70s.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me, you know, and I keep thinking, God, there's so many things we could pursue in here. I mean, you've written things that analogies to, you know, the Vietnam War. You've written things about the rebuilding of a society in the, you know, post-apocalyptic societies that actually you've described as your most hopeful book. Is that correct? Always Coming Home?
Yeah, except it's so long after whatever it is that happened, mm-hmm. which I think is probably more an ecological disaster than mm-hmm. just a... Mm-hmm. Holocaust. I mean, well, it's the other Holocaust. It's the big one we're building
mm-hmm.
now, not the atomic one. Yeah, but it's so long after that, you know. It's not kind of Love Amid the Ruins.
Right, right.
The ruins are so old they've forgotten what they're from.
Hmm. Well, you know, the reason I was getting into this is because I have two more questions for you, and one is. I want to step back again into this point about critical thinking, because, you know, when you think about this and what you've created in, and even, you know, in the gifts where, you know, everything you're led to expect is turned on its head at the end. And you have to actually think, you know, you start to think about, well, wait a minute, there's something that's being posited here that's a minor point until the end of the book, and then you realize that this actually could be the way things were and how they changed and how they developed. But you have to be, you know, you seem to be really pushing people into this point where they can't just accept what's going on. And something I read, a statement that you made, and it may have been in a speech that you recently gave. I guess you were given an award in Washington around literature. And we talked about the relationship between literature and government. And I felt that in that, there's actually a relationship between critical thinking and literature and critical thinking and government. And today, boy or so, I tell you, you can't get away from this. You know, the idea that critical thought or the idea that the kind of books that you write for, that you've written for adolescents in Voices and the Gift, and it's not just for adolescents. I really want to make it clear. Like I said, as I was telling you earlier, I just stayed up and reread the book and I loved it, you know, and I think it's anybody who has any idea of, you know, what's happening in the world today and is looking for some sort of way of digging into this and imagining a way out of it. This book is extremely important. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about how you see that fitting into this whole war on critical thinking that's going on, the war on science even, but the war on critical thought in particular.
Wow. Yeah, the kind of know-nothing thing, we've been told the truth, so we're going to cling to it and shut our eyes and not peek in case there happens to be another inconvenient truth around the corner. Of course, that's exactly what we've done with the ecological disaster. Is just not look. It's more basic than not doing critical thinking. It's just not looking. It's refusing to see what has. I mean, my Lord, we've been told what was going to happen for 30 years. What we're doing with our dependence on oil, for instance, and so on. And we not only will we not think critically, we have refused to think at all. We just sort of go blindly ahead. One is driven to either despair or well, you know, better late than never.
Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking about too is that you know, and I'd ask you this again too, is that, you know, there's this theocracy that you've got posed in Voices, and you know, and there's other places where the whole idea of you know, like as you said, monotheism and fundamentalism and this theocratic rule in society, this is definitely something that I think more and more people in this country have been coming to see as actually a big possibility in terms of the foundational attack, the attacks on things that are foundational, the separation of church and state being demolished, all this. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one thought is right away, let's give Margaret Atwood a little credit there.
Absolutely.
And that Handmaid's Daughter. Remember how she had a really quick, easy takeover of the United States by a theocratic government? One thing they did was simply stop all the credit to women's credit cards. A couple of neat little tricks like that. She was thinking along those lines, too. And she realized way back, that book's what, 20 years old now. How easy, you know, this could happen if the people aren't looking, or if they're clinging to their comfort and ignoring anything that makes them uncomfortable. There's a lot of doom scenarios in science fiction. Goodness knows, I'm not the only one that has. Tried to show how easy it might be to slide into a fascism or a theocracy or any way out of democracy, which is, you know, like Jefferson said, it takes constant maintenance, eternal vigilance.
You know, one of the things, and this is moving on here, but to the final part of this, one of the things in terms of, I don't, you know, when you talked about just presenting these doomed societies. To me, actually, as I told you when I first wrote to you, The Dispossessed was and remains one of my most favorite novels ever. And because not only did you showed worlds that were in contradiction, you showed a world that had its flaws, but still basically a world that was built on a whole different way of humans relating to each other, of people relating to each other. Of beings relating to each other in a world that could be built that wasn't based on commodity production and exchange. It wasn't based on profit and command, but it was based on the consensus of the people interacting with nature and trying to figure out how are we going to get somewhere off of this.
Right.
So now I have two questions for you. You've created a lot of worlds, as I said. You know, you've created a tremendous number of worlds. And You know, the first question I'd have for you is in relation to dispossessed. You actually, when I mentioned that stuff to you about the dispossessed, when I was first writing to you, you wrote back and you said you thought you could not write that book today, but you were so glad that you could write it then. Why would you say that?
To write The Dispossessed took like 3 years of real reading everything any silly anarchist had ever written and a lot of what the Marxists wrote, and trying to pull it together, reading a lot of utopias, and also reading a lot about the nature of time, because my hero was a temporal physicist. Mm-hmm. I was holding more stuff in my head than I can now believe I ever had in my head. I had more energy in those days, let's put it that way. Uh-huh. I just literally couldn't do anything that complicated. Mm-hmm.
When you look around at the you know, what you were just describing, I mean, to me it's just sort of, you know, this whole idea of exploring all these facets of this world. And this brings me to my final question, which is, in all these worlds that you created, I was going to ask you something that I'm robbing from another interviewer that talked with you. Something that actually said, that you were asked, have you ever found a world that you liked? And I was going to ask you that. And then I thought, well, in a way, I would be disappointed if you had, but not just because of traveling around and thought experiments and whatnot, but also just going around and looking at, you know, the idea that the process never ends, you know, and it goes back to this epistemological question we were talking about before, mm-hmm. The process never ends. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Okay, now, have I ever found a world that I liked?
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I like most of the worlds that I discover. If I didn't like them in one way or another, if I didn't find them at least very interesting, I wouldn't want to live in them for the year or two it takes to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
The one I like best is the world of Always Coming Home, which is the Napa Valley. Very obviously is the Napa Valley, a very long time from now in the future, but still, every single plant and animal there is exactly, and even the topography, if you look at the map. Well, I love the Napa Valley, so I overlaid my world on her world mm-hmm. in that one, and that was particularly fun, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Writing that book was a great joy, but it gave me both a nostalgic trip back to my old Napa Valley of the 30s and 40s, which is a pretty different place from mm-hmm. what's there now.
Mm-hmm.
And also the chance to sort of look at it, you know, as you say, rethink it, figure out how could we treat this beautiful piece of the world rightly? How could we live properly, rightly on this land so that we were actually worthy of it instead of just exploiting it? Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, it does. It does. But I'd also, just to, you know, to finish up this point that you've made, you once said that to close the thought process, to clinch a thought, that's really not what you view as an option, to actually just close it down, because it cuts off the realm of possibility.
Oh, no, leave the door open.
Mm-hmm.
If possible, leave all the doors and windows open
mm-hmm.
when you leave the house. That's my policy. Don't you wish we could?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the point, though, is that, you know, the endless possibility there, not just for imagination, but for actually people creating a new world. And that's where we have to get. And I think we have to go through some horrible mess to get there.
You know it. But I agree with you. That's where we have to get. And we do have the capacity to do it, I do think.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ursula, thank you very much for joining me now. And I'll have to have you back to talk about the third book, which is Powers.
Yeah.
Okay, and I want to remind people that I've been talking with Ursula Le Guin, the author of Voices, and the prequel to that, which is called The Gifts, and they're put out by Harcourt. And it's really an amazing book. You know, if you're looking for something to get a younger person you know, or you just want to get it for yourself, you just can't get enough. I can't get enough of it. Ursula, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye now.
All right, that was the late Ursula Le Guin talking about many, many things. And you can see why so many millions of people we're in love with her and her work. We're going to take a musical break right now and be right back with Bob Avakian, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Outer National doing Todos Somos Ilegales. We are all illegals. Now we're going to hear from Bob Avakian speaking about the terror of deportations. Millions of families split apart. And this is taken from a speech called BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less, that was given in late 2012.
Now, since I've been speaking about Obama, I should acknowledge that he has set a record in regard to immigration, a record for deportation. He's deported more than any previous president. And despite some recent moves by Obama to pull back from deporting some immigrants, which, by the way, is something he can easily go back on, and in fact involves a process that could make many people more vulnerable to deportation, and at the same time, Obama has decreed that those not deported in this way are not entitled to important health care benefits. With all that, it is still the case that millions of immigrants, where they are not driven out of this country, are driven into the shadows, constantly living in fear of being deported, constantly vulnerable to the most vicious exploitation. Think about this. Families of immigrants broken apart by forcible deportation. A child comes home from school to find that her parents are not there. And it turns out they've been deported. They're not citizens. She is. The family is split apart. Imagine the terror of being a child coming home from school and you can't find your parents, and finally it comes to you that they've been deported to some country that you, where you've never been and that you know nothing about and have no way of easily getting to. And if you do get to it, you have to uproot your whole life and go to that other country. Think about the terror of that. And I have to say, this calls to mind for me slavery days for black people. The slave owners had absolutely no respect, as I've said, for the humanity of the slaves, including their families. They would repeatedly sell little children out from underneath their parents to another slave owner somewhere else if it were more profitable to sell them to Mississippi. Say you had a plantation in Virginia, and rather than exploiting that slave, raising them up and then putting them to work at an early age on your own plantation, it were more profitable to sell them to someone in Mississippi. That's what you would do, and the tears of the mothers and fathers of those children meant nothing to you. You know the expression, sold down the river. But do people know where that comes from? It comes from this experience of slaves being shipped down the Mississippi and other rivers, including children being ripped away from their parents. And I think of that when I think of a situation of immigrants and families split apart with deportation.
All right, and now we're going to hear BA's response to a question that accompanies the talk given just a few months ago. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. The question is a little hard to hear in this recording, but here it is. Minorities have not been in a very favorable situation in this country to fight against everything that is going against them, because they're not in the land where they originally came from. How can we protect those who need to be on the streets fighting with us? How can we protect the ones that are being targeted directly? And how can we get them to be on the streets?
Since our minds are designed to stop us from doing anything that might hurt us, right? So minorities have been in not in a very favorable situation in this country to fight for everything that, you know, that is going after them, not just Latinos, because they feel like they're not in the right place, they're not in the land where they originally come from. So they don't feel like they're in the position to fight for everything that is going after against them. So how can we protect those who need to be on the streets fighting with us? How can we protect the ones that are being targeted directly when they feel like this is not, they're not in a position to do that, because they will also be terrorized by saying, well, this is not your country, so how can we get them to be on the streets?
Okay, well, that's another important question. I mean, and it's a complicated, the situation is complicated. People
You know, as I was saying earlier, there are real consequences for people in standing up, even against their own oppression. There are real consequences. You know, it can always get worse. And people, you know, for example, who are undocumented are very vulnerable now. And I think there are different levels to this. One, all these different outrages are things that everybody has to be outraged about, not just the people who are most directly affected. This is an important thing we have to struggle with. When, you know, as I said, you know, this idea that, well, maybe, you know, maybe I can avoid the horrors happening to me and my loved ones and those I most care about is deadly. And, you know, and will be the death of any real movement that we need. So there needs to be a struggle with everybody, you know, and people have to learn that, you know, this is a subject of struggle too, that, you know, just because you don't get immediate results doesn't mean you should stop. Like in this country, you know, in the recent decades, by the way, I wanted to say one other thing I forgot to say about your question in the media. Just let me just say this before I forget. Social media, that's very important too. Let's get all over social media and break through in that way. I just wanted to, in addition to all the other things about the media that were raised. But, you know, people have to be, you know, oriented that if something is important, you have to keep on struggling for it. You know, this is a land where we're conditioned for, you know, short attention spans and immediate gratification. You know, that's a problem that has to be struggled with. And what am I referring to? Well, the original travel ban came out from Trump. And, you know, there was a really good response where thousands of people went to airports and protested. That was really good. But then people get worn down. You know, Trump didn't say, oh, well, people protest, so I guess I shouldn't have a travel ban. You know, he's determined to have this travel ban. So he keeps reshaping it in different forms, and there's things go on in the courts, and he reshapes it. Now he's got another one. You know, and unfortunately, when he came out with a slightly, you know, altered version that didn't have everything bad that was in the first one, then there wasn't the same kind of outpouring that there was initially. Well, this is something that we have to break through on with people. That's the point about sustained resistance. So there were good sentiments and there was a good outpouring of people who weren't directly involved. Overwhelmingly, people went to airports were not Muslims or from the countries affected. The same thing has happened around DACA. The same thing has happened around deportations. People have protested, but it's not enough. You know, to protest once, this has to be sustained. You know, put it this way: if something was outrageous and you protest and it doesn't stop, it hasn't gotten less outrageous. Mm-hmm. So, therefore, you have to, you know, we have to win people that you have to keep, you have to keep moving around this. But that's where the point comes in about if you don't drive out the regime. As important as different fronts of resistance are, you're just fighting ultimately a losing battle on all these different fronts because they have maintained the initiative and this regime is still in power. So you have to sustain the resistance, but it has to be, you know, geared and directed toward what will deal, you know, with all of this because there's a whole package of things. I spoke to it in the very beginning of my, you know, remarks. There's a whole package of things they're doing all at once, and it does feel overwhelming to people. But, you know, we have to win people, you know, to see the need to, you know, to both sustain resistance, but more than that, and, you know, crucially, to actually direct all of that toward driving out this regime, beginning with, you know, November 4th, and moving and sustaining. Now, to go back to the question of more directly about people who are vulnerable, I think that there's a two-pronged answer or an answer on two levels. One is what I've been talking about. Other people have to get involved, and other people have to take this. We're not directly affected in this or that thing, including deportations. Have to take the stand that this is intolerable and we won't allow it. You know, that's one thing that has to happen. Look, as long as the regime's in power, you're not going to be able to win on that, you know. But you have to have that orientation. It's intolerable, and since it's intolerable, we're not just going to sit by and complain. We're actually going to, you know, have the stand that we're not going to allow it. The other thing is that the right tactics have to be developed so that people who are directly affected but have, you know, potentially high price to pay for getting involved can get involved, because, you know, we can't. Here's the problem, to put it really honestly. We cannot protect people from what the people in power are intending to do to them, other than by driving out the people in power. If that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be measures taken to protect people tactically in certain situations. You know, a lot of creative, look, people are very creative. You see a lot of creativity whenever people are motivated about things. Sometimes really stupid things, but there's still a lot of creativity. Sometimes really important things, you know, even things that get made fun of, you know, like when they had the Women's March the day after the inauguration, all the pussy hats and stuff. There's a lot of creative stuff, you know, that people do. So the creative means should be developed to do the best we can to protect people who are particularly vulnerable to attack. But on the other hand, there is no cheap and easy way to deal with what we're confronted with. And we have to be honest with people about that. We have to bring forward the massive thing that will drive out this regime and create a much more favorable political situation in this country, or real horrors are going to come down on people all over the world, including environmental destruction. I mean, look, I sometimes feel like this. You, adjective, expletive, people who voted for Trump, okay, you know, you want to vote for Trump. According to the rules of the system, you have a right to vote for, you know, whomever you want. You don't have a f***ing right to drag all of humanity down to oblivion. You know, and this is what we're dealing with here. And so there, you know, this is what we're confronted with. And there, you know, we have to do our best to protect each other, and not just in a narrow little small group way, but in thinking in terms of thousands and millions. But, you know, I'm just going to tell the truth. This fight will not be won without sacrifice. You know, it would be great if it could be, but it can't be. And if we tell people a lie, we're just going to set them up for even worse things. We're going to have to sacrifice. I mean, you know, some of you may be familiar with the statement by this pastor Niemöller, who lived during the time of Hitler in Germany in the 1930s and 40s. And he, you know, he himself was persecuted, but he made this statement he made two statements. One of them people are more familiar with. He said, "First they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist, so I said nothing. Then they came for the Jews, but I wasn't a Jew, so I said nothing. Then they came for the trade unionists, but I wasn't a trade unionist, so I said nothing. Then they came for me, and there was nobody there to stand up with me." But he also said, and look, I'm not saying these are the terms that we're confronting now, but he also said, if all of us who hated this had stood up at the beginning, maybe many of us, even thousands, would have had to die, but at least we would have prevented the horrors that were brought forth. Now, I'm not saying here, look, people's lives are precious. I'm not saying that, you know, sacrifice is an easy thing or talking about it lightly or anything like that. But if we recognize what we're dealing with, we also have to recognize that it's not going to be achieved without sacrifice. We should never give, you know, the people who are responsible for all these horrors any cheap victories. We should never allow them to have any cheap taking of people's lives or their freedom or anything like that. People are precious. People's freedom is precious, and we should understand and act accordingly. But we also have to recognize that, and this applies for all of us, we're going to have to sacrifice to deal with what we're dealing with. And that's just the plain truth. And people have to understand that. And people are capable of great heroism, again, when they understand two things. When they understand why it's necessary, and when they feel that they are not acting all on their own and in isolation, but together with many other people who recognize and are standing up for the same thing.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with a question that accompanies the talk, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible." Now, in this film, Avakian analyzes the deep roots and driving forces of Trump-Pence fascism and what must be done to stop it. This talk was given a few months ago in 2017, but as you can see from the part I just played today in 2018, this talk on the Trump-Pence regime is, day by day, more and more relevant. In fact, it's more relevant than ever. Both the talk and the talk that the earlier segment is from, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, are accessible through revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom.us. You can also find links to these on my Facebook page. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Sound the Alarm from Thievery Corporation. Talk to you again next week. And remember, do sound that alarm.